Joe Rogan Podcast, check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
International man of mystery, world travel man, author extraordinaire. You're you have a broad range of experiences that you can draw upon, Mr. Chris Ryan.
And I do, but
appreciate you very much coming back here again. Thanks, man.
It's an honor.
Oh, please, it's an honor to have you back. Your book is amazing. If you haven't read it, I've been reading it over the past few months, along with the new Steve Rinella book, Meat Eater. I throw you back and forth with this book.
Yeah,
it's a great book, man. There's so much interesting shit in it. It's such a fascinating sort of exposure about sexuality and evolution and how we sort of evolved and how we've, you know, got to this point where it's kind of it's gotten away from us, and there's all this. I think Duncan Trussell said it best. He said that you exercise shame from people.
You know what?
I love that term.
I told you I'm working on a new website using Squarespace.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is not bullshit. I'm not saying that because they're your sponsor. But my, you know, I've got Chris Ryan, and then under it says author, public speaker or something. Shame exorcist. I love that phrase. Yeah,
that book is for a lot of people. It makes you go, oh, okay, that's where these fucked up thoughts are coming. I'm not fucked up. The system's fucked up. Oh, we're right. Living in this crazy time of shame, time of oddly defined identities and roles that we're supposed to take on that seem very unnatural.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the weird times. We live in weird times sexually.
I think we do. You know the Chinese thing, you know, may you live in interesting times,
yes.
Which is a curse,
uh-huh.
You know. But I think we do. We do live in very interesting times. There's a quote we use in the book from the playwright Arthur Miller, who was married to Marilyn Monroe for a while. He said, an era can be considered over when its basic illusions have been exhausted. I love that quote. Basic illusions have been exhausted.
Yes.
And I think we live in a time where pretty much all our basic illusions are exhausted. Politics, nobody thinks there. Well, the shit that's going on in Washington is anything other than, you know, back deal trading for whatever. You know, banking, nobody believes banking is for the good of the country anymore. It's like people have realized that everyone's on the take. The institutions are not respected, and that includes marriage to a large extent. And so there's this struggle going on over marriage and monogamy and gay rights, you know, in terms of same-sex marriage. So I think we're in this war. I mean, there's so many things. Diet, you know, you're on the forefront of a lot of this sort of recalibrating, you know, what works, what's right, what actually has benefits, you know, as opposed to the bullshit that we're being fed all the time. So, and I think a lot of that's, you know, due to the internet, probably, that you can, you know, if your message is strong enough, it doesn't matter who you are or who's backing you, you can reach people. So I think, yeah, I think we're in really interesting times.
There's an effect on our culture that the workforce, the workplace brings, and it's, every day during the workplace, at the workplace.
You want some of my black butt?
Oh, no, I'm good. Thanks, man. That's a beer. That's a beer, ladies and gentlemen. It's Black Butte.
Oh, Butte.
Yeah, Butte, sir. Butte. It's a delicious porter ale. I would like to have one of those. Can Jim get one? I drank some of that for the first time when I was, I want to say Chicago. Where I think I was in Chicago. Yeah. It was like the greatest beer I've ever had in my life.
From Bend, Oregon.
Yeah. What's the name of the company?
Deschutes.
Yeah. Deschutes Brewery.
Yeah.
Deschutes.
Hey, yeah. How dare you?
Now, they should be a sponsor. I mean,
no,
really.
How about we just pump them up for
just
free?
For free. All right. Well, it's good. It's good beer. And that's from a guy who doesn't like porter much. I was saying earlier, it's normally kind of heavy and sweet for me, but this is nice.
Yeah, no, that's delicious. What were we talking about before we got off on the beer?
Workplace. You were talking about the workplace.
Thanks, sir. I really feel like because of the fact that you have to, when you're in an office all day, especially with men and women working together, there's this sort of professionalism that you have to project. There's this sort of fake way of communicating where you've completely eradicated anything sexual from the menu of conversation.
Yeah.
And even discussing it in the periphery, dancing around it with a joke can easily get you fired.
Yeah.
Now, you know about this dongle gate thing. Are you aware of this?
No, I've heard reference to it, but I haven't looked into it.
It's a fascinating story. that has taken place over the last few days in the tech world. There was a woman, a self-professed feminist, blogger woman. Sorry, folks, I got a little phlegm. James, give me some tissues. I got to blow my nose. This woman was at a conference, and some men behind her made a joke about dongles. It was, you know, someone said dongle on stage. They essentially were like...
What is a dongle?
I don't know. Some part of something. But what they were essentially doing was doing like a high-tech version of Beavis and Butthead. Like, he said dongle. I wonder how big his dongle is. You know, so these guys, I don't know what the joke was.
Yeah.
But so she takes a photo of these guys and then puts that photo online and says, hey, these guys are violating the code of conduct for the seminar. And these guys are on, you know, in your conference, they're making jokes about dongles.
Right.
Not cool.
Right.
Okay, so these guys get fired. And one guy gets fired. He's got three kids. And this woman writes this blog sort of justifying, like, the environment that, you know, that sort of makes cool. And that the reason why she decided to come out is because there was a little girl on stage or a little girl in the room or whatever. And she was thinking, what this little girl, you know, if I don't stand up and stop this, what is she going to be exposed to? Which is kind of grandiose when you're talking about dongles. I mean, Jesus fucking Christ. But what's truly fascinating about this whole thing is, first of all, the response by the internet. Because the man was fired, don't put those guys online, dude.
Oh.
Why are we doing that? I mean, there's no need to keep... Yeah, I know. I mean, I just don't think... They didn't ask to be online. Those guys never asked to be... Those photos were taken by this woman and turned into this big thing. She has, like, an online media thing that she does already.
Yeah.
So she has, like, a big presence.
Right.
A lot of Twitter followers. And she just took a photo of these guys and just put them out in the world for no reason. I mean, they didn't ask for it.
Right.
And she says, here's the guys that tell the dongle joke. So one guy gets fired. She writes this crazy blog. And Anonymous jumps in. And they're like, what? Fuck you.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were like, this is absolutely fucking preposterous. The way this woman's behaving is repulsive. And it just, they went off. And so they threatened the company. And they said they were going to, you know, go after their clients. And they were going to, you know, denial of service attacks and whatever they were going to do.
Right.
They're like, I don't know if they even directly threatened it or, you know, indirectly threatened it.
Right.
But they're like, you got to, this is just the beginning. You got to get rid of this chick. And they fired her immediately.
Oh, I thought you meant the company that fired the guy. Did they
bring
the
company.
Guy back?
Oh, I don't know if they brought the guy back. But the guy should get a job at a company that's not a bunch of fucking pussies. Because that's the most ridiculous shit ever.
Good luck
dongle?
Finding one, man. You know, isn't it like
the word
everybody
dongle
gets...
is nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I haven't had a job since the 80s. So I'm not the guy that really, you know.
Right.
But I can't imagine pissing into a cup to have a job. I don't understand that.
Drug test. We're having drug tests. Insanity. Complete insanity.
What the fuck does it matter if I smoked a joint 2 weeks ago and I come into work today? What the hell are we talking about? It's insane.
Complete total insanity. And it's just this sort of design to get people moving in this direction of blind obedience.
Right.
And that's what your employer would like for you.
Right. But by the way, I think that's another one of these basic illusions that's exhausted. We got Rand Paul coming out for legalizing drugs, apparently.
Yes. Yeah.
I just saw the headline. You know, so I think maybe we've turned a corner. It's gotten so crazy that, you know, Anonymous is standing up. That's great.
I think the internet represents the real mind of the people today. And I think when a big movement like this sweeps across the internet, and this is a very minor one, let's go with a major one. Let's go with WikiLeaks.
Right.
The overwhelming support of WikiLeaks by people online as opposed to how it's represented in the mainstream media is a big difference.
Well, isn't it people online? It's like people 35 and under mostly.
I don't think so anymore. No, I don't think that's applicable anymore. I think pretty much everybody's online. I think there's been, over the last decade, there's been this assimilation towards older and older folks. And then the people who are 30 are now 40. And it's just, I think the ideas are too powerful and the method of distribution is too powerful. And now we're dealing with this ancient paradigm that doesn't really work with the amount of information that we have today. It's like this old car that we're trying to keep fixing and putting new tires on. But it's Cuba. A fucking Model T. It's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Worse than Cuba, because Cuba's got at least cool
nice
old cars.
You know? Exactly.
They really take care of well.
Oh, beautiful.
It's an amazing model of, like, recycling, yeah. Like, true recycling, and the unnecessary aspects of constantly getting new and improved things.
A friend of mine wrote a book called Che's Chevrolet and Castro's Oldsmobile or something like that. I mean, his name's Richard Schwide. He's written, this guy is so interesting. He's published like 7 books, one on chili peppers, one on cockroaches, one on, you know, life after death, one on Cuban cars. He just like eels. He's got a book on eels.
Wow.
He just like gets a hair up his ass and decides something's interesting and he'll just like, you know, run it down and write a book about it and then move on to something else.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What I was saying earlier before I got sidetracked about the workplace is that the suppression of your true humanity in the workplace, your ability to be
right.
free and to be yourself
right.
and to joke around and have fun. Especially when there's intersex politics, when there's, you know, there's a cross of men and women working together, there's this sort of like fakeness that goes on all day. And then there's this other level of fakeness that goes on when you're out in the nightlife time and you're trying to get laid. Like, so there's that fakeness as well.
Yeah.
And there's just such a small percentage of time that humans, men and women throughout the day, interact with each other on a truly honest level. Mm. You know, so like, it takes fucking decades to understand each other. It takes decades as a man to just try to wrap your head around the idea of wanting babies growing inside of you and wanting dicks and, you know, and being attracted to men. Just wrapping your head around that. It's a very strange concept.
Yeah.
And because we bullshit each other all day at work, because we bullshit each other when we go out on dates or social events, we pretend to be someone, you know, more sophisticated or interesting than we truly are.
Yeah.
I think that the amount of time it takes before you start understanding how people really are, as opposed to these bizarre patterns that we keep following. You know,
yeah.
It seems.
And you didn't even mention media. Think
yeah.
of all the bullshit media pumps into us about each other, men and women, in
you know,
relationship.
I have had a unique relationship with television, and then I've been on a couple shows that went on a long time. I was on news radio for 5 years, and then I was on Fear Factor for 6 years.
Right.
So when people say, oh, there's a conspiracy and the government's trying to dumb us down through television, that's not what's happening. Mm. What's happening is that's what you're buying.
Right.
That's what they're selling because that's what you're buying.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why it's gotten darker and weirder over the past few years is because
yeah.
you're on the internet now. And
yeah.
The Walking Dead could not have fucking existed a decade ago. There's
right.
no way you could have that on television. I saw a dude get his yeah. leg hacked off with a hatchet. You know, I mean, you see crazy shit.
I couldn't
yeah.
believe what was on.
But
that
the sheer yeah. violence and insanity of The Walking Dead is impossible without the internet.
Right.
You know,
and video games.
Yes.
Probably. Yeah.
Sure, video
yeah.
games. Absolutely. These uncensored environments. But that information's there now,
yeah.
so they have to adjust and change things. But the reason why Fear Factor existed or CSI exists, it's not that the government is like trying to convince you if you make a mistake, we'll catch you. We can take your fingerprints from the air. You know, like, no. It's just, that's what you want. You want crime shows. You're
right.
buying crime shows.
Right.
If you buy crime shows, well, because you're scared, because you're like, what's happening in the world? Well, oh, what if the bad guy? So you're living your life in these weird paranoid ideas through this artificial medium.
Right.
But no one's trying to brainwash you. You think they are, but it's really more a matter of this is what people actually buy.
Yeah.
And is it because that's what they've been sold forever? Yeah, that too. Definitely that too.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of dummies out there. There's
no,
a lot of dummies that just want to sit in front of that TV and watch someone go to yeah. what's going to happen on Law and Order. I'm going to guess the bad guy's going to lose because I'm
in the final
crazy.
Act. In the
yeah.
final. You know, I agree with you. Although I do think that there is – it's not brainwashing, but I think who is it? Marshall McLuhan, who said the medium is the message, right?
Yeah.
So there's certain things that you sell that are easier to sell through TV, so you sell those, right? And the structure. I mean, I'm writing this book now. It's Civilized to Death. It's called, and so I'm really like deep into this shit. But it's like there are. Institutions are organic beings. Companies are organic beings. So they You're right. They sell. They provide what sells because they need to eat. They need to feed, you know, and grow. But I do think that there are structural, how can I say it, like structural biases that divert or sort of focus the media in different ways. And I think internet is great because it's so dispersed,
mm-hmm.
whereas TV is very, I'm selling to you.
Right.
I don't hear a thing you say except through Nielsen ratings or some shit like that.
It's like they're getting smoke signals. They're not getting a conversation.
Right. Whereas the internet, it's like, wow, you got clicks, you got eyes, you can measure everything.
It's
interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of, you know, this is what we're going to offer you, it doesn't exist on the internet. The choices are so vast that, and the freedom that anybody, like you have a podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anybody
tangentially
can...
speaking, as you can tell, it's my style.
Perfect. Yeah, me too. Yeah, well, you're perfect for this podcast. anything along these lines, the YouTube videos that people have, the Young Turks, people have these video.
My last episode was with the Young Turks.
That couldn't have existed.
Yeah, we talked about you.
Yeah,
oh, they like you. Yeah,
okay, I like them too. Yeah. It couldn't have existed without the YouTube possibility.
Right.
You know, the internet possibility without that sort of a platform.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of overwhelming the old paradigm, and it's slowly starting to erode. But I also feel that the workplace, like people having to bullshit all day, is counterproductive to it. And it becomes a major part of your awake time programming.
Yeah. It's so American, too.
Yes.
I have to say, in Spain, you know, I can't speak for Spain in general, but I've been there 20 years, so I'm pretty well familiar with the culture. But it's like one of the things I love about Spain is that politically correct sort of, you know, men are the enemies of women, and, you know, adolescent joking can get you fired from your job. That isn't happening.
Mm.
Now, women could have a legitimate point by saying, yeah, because women's status in Spain isn't as high as it is in, you know, there aren't legal protections, and, you know, women get, you know, harassed in the street or whatever. And that's all true. So I don't mean to say Spain is across the board better. But one thing I notice in Spain, and I love about Spain, is that women don't assume you're a rapist because you smile at them. You know, they don't assume you've got bad intentions. In fact, they assume you probably have good intentions, and you just find them attractive, and they smile back, and everybody keeps walking, and it's like a win-win, you know? There's no assumption of victimization going on. And I think in America, there's this assumption, you know, that you know what, there's a little girl on stage, and these guys are making a dumbass joke. Somehow that's connected, and I got to expose this? I don't see that. In Spain, you don't see that sort of shit.
Well, the fury that people had was this: they weren't joking with her. They weren't.
Yeah.
Like, they're joking amongst themselves,
right,
in literally the most innocent language possible for describing a dick,
right,
you know, or in alluding to a dick,
right.
And that was enough for her to go, I've had enough. Like, there's a craziness to that. And someone made a video called Toxic Women and Stupid Men, and it's on YouTube, and it in a very intelligent way details why people that think like this are a real issue, and the men who allow them to get away with it without saying this is preposterous, they're a real issue too. Because there's a lot of white knights out there. There's a lot of really dumb, weak dudes that want to pretend that they're with the girls.
Right.
They think like, you know, you're right, these men are assholes, and they'll make videos about it, and what they're looking for is like feminine brownie points.
Right.
They want feminists to look at them and say, yeah, you're one of us. And it's not necessarily that they don't actually think that way. A lot of people are like, you're wrong. I believe you do think like that, but I'm telling you that the motivation for anybody thinking like that is false. You have a crazy, ridiculous way of looking at things. It's unbalanced. If you had no sex whatsoever, not male nor female, and you looked at that as two human beings, and one human being was fired because another human being made a joke about something that was being referenced on stage in a playful manner, should that person be, take sex out of it, should that person be fired?
Right.
And if you say yes, you're a cunt.
Right.
That's the reality of the situation. You're a fucking toxic person. That's a shitty way of looking at things.
Yeah.
And by the way, I should stress that this woman did not want these guys to be fired. She did not think that was her intent. She wanted them shut up.
Right,
and it's whatever it is. Maybe she's self-righteous. Maybe she likes to go off on tangents.
Yeah.
I don't think she should be fired. I don't think he should be fired. I think it has nothing to do with whatever the fuck they do during the day. But I think it's fascinating when people are forced to behave in a certain way. Like you're locked into this sort of nonsense environment where you can't even talk about dongles.
Yeah. You know, there's an article at salon.com, I think last week I linked to it, and it started this big firestorm on my Facebook page, where a woman wrote about an experience she'd had the first time she'd had sex. I think she was 15 or something, and she was with a guy a couple of years older, and she had a few too many drinks.
You read it.
Yeah. And so she was saying that wasn't rape. Right. I made a bad decision. I had sex that I later regretted. It wasn't rape. And apparently, there's a huge firestorm around this.
Yes, there is, because there's the feminist movement right now. Then one of the ideas that they're pushing is the idea that is in place, I believe, in Sweden, where the idea being that regret means that you can withdraw your consent.
Which is where Julian Assange is being accused of rape, even though the woman he supposedly raped went out with him again the next night.
Yeah, and had sex with him right before. He was being accused of, I don't want to speak out of school, but I'm pretty sure it was called surprise sex. That was the idea.
And they were sleeping and they had sex again without a condom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and she didn't want this, or she was upset at this, or whatever. You know, obviously they were looking to get at him for something else.
Yeah.
But that's about as obvious you can get that one. I mean, that is just fucking crazy. Oh, it just so happens that it's the same guy.
That
you got no beef with him about leaking all that information. That's cool because there's no law against that, right? Is that what's going on?
Yeah.
But the other shit, you can lock him up in a fucking embassy for.
Bradley Manning? What the fuck, man? They torture Bradley Manning.
They truly tortured him.
He's a hero. Yeah.
That guy was in solitary confinement for some insane hundreds and hundreds of days with no contact with another person.
Yeah.
Which they say literally can make you crazy.
Yeah, sure.
And they would take his clothes off because they thought that he was a security risk. So he's cold and
lights
naked.
Lights all night.
Lights constantly. And, you know, for what? Because he did what really his patriotic duty led him to believe that he should do.
Right.
He should release information that he believes is contrary to the nature of contrary to the idea of what most people view of the military as only good guys over there killing bad guys.
And contrary to the law.
Yes.
You know, international and American law.
Yeah. Yeah, what he did was the New York Times is supposed to do.
What Ellsberg did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's, you know, so I think the view of that, that's getting back to the internet thing, on the internet, that's pretty, I mean, amongst the people that I communicate with, that's pretty much unanimous. I mean, pretty much everybody is like, well, you know, at the very least, this exposes a real issue that should be dealt with in the military. But you don't hear that from mainstream media.
Right.
From mainstream media, they have eliminated that guy from the discussion. You never hear him being talked about.
See, that's what I was saying earlier. Like the structure of the institution dictates what information can go through there. So because of the corporate interest, because GE owns NBC or whatever, and GE also makes the fucking missiles and the helicopters and the rest of it, they're not going to be able to take that perspective because they're not independent. That's bullshit, right?
Well, as some people like the Young Turks come along, they really become archaic. They don't make any sense anymore because the Young Turks will tell you, you know, they're going to tell you what they believe 100%, what that guy believes. What they might not be right. They might be. I mean, he was off about Breitbart, about with the whole Andrew Weiner thing. He made fun of Breitbart for releasing
Jenk.
Saying he's an idiot for doing it. And it turned out to be true.
Right.
But you know that's him. That's him.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's talking straight to the camera.
Right.
So maybe he doesn't have the correct information at the time. But what he's telling you, it's not being pushed by producers. It's not being pushed by a network. It's not being pushed by a corporate entity behind the network.
Right.
You can't say that about the news that we've come to accept as the mainstream news, whether it's CNN or Fox. There's no individual voice. There's no individual point of view.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially, I mean, occasionally you have people will give editorials, but those editorials are just, Jesus Christ, they're like cartoonish. They're cartoonish and nonsensical, especially like Fox News is going to be about the Democrats. Obama's fucking up and returning to socialism. It's going to be so obvious. You don't even have to say it. Just show me what color flag are you holding up. You got a red flag or a blue flag?
Right.
I got your message. Just show me a red. Show me a flash of red. And that idea is basically just as good as whatever the fuck comes out of your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to have me back a third time, huh? Because we're never going to talk about
We will, though, man. We will. We will. But I really wanted to have you on after this dongle gate broke out because I think one of the things that your book really really highlights is the weirdness in which women are not supposed to accept their sexuality or accept the fact that they get horny or
right.
broadcast it in any way or even, you know, acknowledge it. And that if there's a sexual joke going on where a man, even if he doesn't even involve that woman, makes some sort of a sexual joke, that somehow that woman is a victim because she doesn't want to have anything to do with sex.
Right.
She doesn't want to have anything to do with either their advances or jokes about
it. Very Victorian image. You know, the Victorian era, you only had sex with your wife in order to have babies.
Right.
You had sex to have sex with courtesans, with prostitutes, with, you know, the housemaid, with whatever. You didn't fuck your wife for fun. Or for pleasure.
Was that across the board? Like agreed to?
Upper class Victorian British society across the board. You know, in France and in other European societies, there was a different vibe. But that's the society Darwin came out of, right? And as we try to explain in the book, that's the mentality that informs our understanding and the scientific view of human sexual evolution. Because Darwin was an uptight guy. He was great. He was a genius. He was a cool guy. But he was super repressed sexually.
He never had sex ever, right? Isn't that
only with his wife, who was his first cousin from the Wedgwood family, which are the Wedgwood China fortune. You know, they're still making China in England. And she was 30, I think. He was 29. And his brother married another
sister. I confused
it
with Newton.
Right.
Newton was asexual,
yeah, Newton
right?
was asexual, right. Yeah.
During the Victorian era, didn't they cover up like legs of pianos?
Right. And tables and chairs.
Are you serious?
And
yes.
Oh yeah, because it would excite people.
Yes.
Oh,
it's so God. It's yeah. so amazing.
It's like the burqa now, you know. That's why
Oh, it's crazier than the burqa.
Yeah. But you know what's cool about the burqa? I'm pitching this TV show, which seems like it's gonna get picked up, by the way, and one of the episodes is based on the story I heard from a woman who worked at Victoria's Secret in London. And she told me that most of the lingerie they sold was to very wealthy Saudi and Kuwaiti women who came in and would just like buy out the store because they wear sexy lingerie under their burqas.
Yeah, but it's under that stupid tent. It's only
good
for one dude.
Sexy.
Yeah,
they
do. I mean, it's got to be compensating for the fact that
yeah.
they're forced to wear that stupid outfit.
I
don't think there's anything good about that outfit.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing good about it is if you're the man, like, man, nobody gets a look at this shit.
Yeah.
This is mine.
I'm going into the tent.
It's just what's offensive is not the religious connection to it. The suppression, the idea
right.
that a woman has to wear that.
Right.
It's the most suppressing thing ever. You're
yeah.
covering everything about your identity.
Right.
Especially it fucks up a girl if she's in a shit relationship and she's looking for another dude. She's looking for a little escape plan.
Right.
You know, that guy
right.
has know what the fuck he's getting into.
Right.
You
dress... Or she's getting abused and
exactly.
nobody can see her bruises.
Marks.
So,
that's
yeah.
another way. Yeah,
yeah.
That's another point. Yeah.
But anyway, I jumped off. What were we talking about?
I don't know.
Fucking
aren't
you
burkas and shit.
Before that, what the hell was it? Oh man, I'm not even stoned. And
we were just talking about the suppression of sexuality that women don't feel like.
The Victorians and Darwin and all that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, when we originally pitched this book, it was called "What Darwin Didn't Know About Sex," and the idea was to write a biography of Darwin's sex life. And then, like, tie that into our modern misconceptions of sexuality. Because he had lots of opportunity, right? He went on the Beagle all down around South America, across the South Pacific. They stopped in Tahiti, which is sexual paradise, especially in the 19th century.
It was sexual paradise?
That's why the mutiny on the Bounty happened. Because the Bounty, you've seen the movie, right? The Marlon Brando.
No, I haven't. I never saw that movie.
Well, it's this. So the Bounty, I guess, was... Captain, I don't remember what his name was, Captain something Flesher or something like that. But anyway, it was a British whaling ship, I think, or mapping ship maybe. But anyway, it stopped in Tahiti to spend about a month or 2 months there to, like, you know, get fresh water and fix the ship and do all this stuff. Meanwhile, the dudes went down and they were on the island, and there's a very relaxed sexual situation in Tahiti and in many parts of the world. And so these repressed British sailors who hadn't seen a woman in God knows how long, suddenly there are all these beautiful women around who are happy to have sex with them just for fun. And So these guys are getting laid left and right. And then the badass captain says, all right, everybody back on the ship. We're going back to sea. They get about, you know, 4 hours out to sea, and there's a mutiny. Because the dudes are like, fuck this. I don't want to go back to England. We're going back to Tahiti, man. So that's what they did. So this is this famous case. Because there was, like, lots of nice pussy in Tahiti, you know?
You mean nice women. When you say pussy, you're objectifying women. You're breaking them down to one body part.
You're right.
There's a nice gash.
I know what you're – hey, that's even worse. I know your intentions are pure, sure. But for our women friends out there, that would be the white knight take on it.
Well done. Well,
you know,
done.
Calling them by their sexual organs is really not cool, man.
Well, last night I was at a party and a woman said some guy was a real dick. And everyone laughed. And I said, that's funny. If I said someone was a cunt, well, that would be sort of nasty, right? And so we got into this whole conversation about how come one body part's offensive and the other isn't.
Well, cunt is like if she called him a cock. That guy's a cock.
That
like,
might even be
that
a compliment.
Is still, depending on how the guy felt about the girl, you know, if he thought he was the shit, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
That'd be devastating.
I was a couple weeks ago, I gave a TED talk, you know, talking about this corporate environment. And, you know, TED's wonderful. I think you had a guest, you had a guy who was there.
Eddie Huang.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And like, Graham Hancock, who also has had issues with
Graham
him
Hancock's had a very interesting situation. And Sheldrake.
Yeah.
Rupert Sheldrake is good friends with Stanley Krippner, who you're going to be interviewing Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah. He probably knows Hancock as well. I don't know.
All those old hippies stick together.
Yeah, intellectual, freaky guys. Anyway, so I've got this presentation, and when I did the rehearsal, one of the slides in the presentation is that I've used all over and, you know, colleges all over and stuff. I'm talking about testicular ratio and how that explains certain things about our ancestors. So I've got in one corner, there's a gorilla lying on his back in the sun, and there's like nothing. He's got no balls at all. They're like the size of kidney beans. They're inside his abdomen, so you don't see anything. On the other corner, there's a bonobo who's got balls the size of chicken eggs. And in the middle, there's a picture of this buddy of mine in a Speedo sitting on a hammock, and he's got pretty big balls. And so it says like gorilla, bonobo, and over my friend, it says Italian, right? And that always gets a huge laugh when I do that. I did this at TED, and they were like, okay, you know, after the rehearsal, they were like, oh, that was really good. That's great. Except that one slide. And they thought Italians would be offended.
Oh, my God.
And I was saying, you tell an Italian he's got big balls. That's a compliment.
Little do they know they have big balls because the Italian women are so promiscuous.
You read the book.
Yes. Devastating. Devastating to the Italian mentality.
Exactly.
Damn, I can't believe it.
Maybe that's the part that's insulting.
The size of your package is directly proportionate to how slutty the girls around you are.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say slutty. And that was another fascinating aspect of your book that I learned, the origins of the word promiscuous. That everybody sort of assumes that when you say girl's promiscuous, that she just sleeps with strangers and runs around. She's got loose morals. That's not the root of the word. The root of the word is mixed, meaning she has sex with more than one person, or she has relations with more than one person.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, probably knew those people her entire life, because the real origins of these sort of orgiastic tribal societies are that there's only 50 of them. They were living together in the woods,
right.
And they knew each other from the time they were born, and they had sex with each other, and they had sexual relationships with more than one person. And our ideas of, you know, monogamy, it's great if it works for you, in 2013 and the corporate world and the legal world, it's great. But if you look at 50 people living alone in the woods, staying bonded together, the best way for everybody to truly love each other is everybody fucks everybody. I mean, you really are like monkey people. I mean, you're monkey people with more advanced genetics and more advanced tools and shit, but you're essentially living not much different than, you know, than an animal with tools, you know?
Chimps.
Yeah. I mean, that's how people at the dawn of time lived.
Yeah.
Those people, it would benefit them to be sexually engaged each other. It would benefit them to be polyamorous. It would benefit them to have love spread out, you know, deep, intense love with a bunch of tribal members.
Yeah. No question. In fact, when I was you know, I'd done all this research on tribal people and their really interesting rituals that are seem designed to make sure that people don't break down into nuclear families, right? They're designed to make sure, even though you and this woman really like being together and you know, your hammocks are next to each other and you spend most of your time together, that's great. And we're not saying that there was no pair bonding, right, in prehistory. But all these cultures seem to have these rituals to make sure that you and your woman both have sex with other people, right? So, like, there are tattooing ceremonies where everybody has sex and it's prohibited to have sex with your normal partner.
Whoa. Or where? What wacky fucking culture is this?
It's in the Amazon. There are lots of them and in the South Pacific.
That's what happens when you don't have the internet. You start getting crazy.
Yeah.
That's one asshole's idea. One, you know, it's one guy. Listen, I'm going to fuck your wife. You're going to fuck my wife. I don't want to fuck your wife, dude. Come on. We're going to make it a law. make it a law. Anytime you have to make it a law, that's fucking silly. That, I mean, their social engineering is no better than ours.
Yeah.
You know? Well, there's still do what you want to do.
There's this other society. It's the Kulina. Don Pollock was the anthropologist who lived with them for 20 years. And he talks about this ritual. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it translates to the order to get meat. And the women will wake up in the morning and they get together and they say, okay, let's do this thing today. So they all start singing and they'll go around the village singing the song that translates to, you guys are lazy. We don't get enough meat. When are you going to give us some meat? We want meat, right? So they're singing this, and I asked him, does meat have a double meaning? And he said, yeah, definitely. It's like
same as
go hunting, but also right. Give us some dick, right? So while they're singing the song, they go around, and the women will beat on the post that's holding the guy's hammock. And that means if you go hunting today and you bring back some meat, I'll sleep with you tonight. So it's like a motivation to, you know, get out of your hammock and go hunting. But you can't hit the post of your normal partner. It has to be someone else, right? So then the men can, if they don't, like if you don't want to have sex with a woman who hit your post, you can say, oh, my stomach's not good today, you know, whatever, I'm not feeling well. You don't have to do it. But so the guys who get up, they'll like get up and be all, oh, you know, grumbly and pissed off. And then they'll go leave the village together. But this area, they hunt mostly monkeys. And so they hunt independently, right, because the monkeys are spread out. So but before they split up to go hunting, they'll agree to meet at this certain point before they go into the village. So they or the camp or whatever. So they'll go out. Some of them will get a monkey. Some won't. They meet back at this place and they cut up the monkey so that everybody has a piece of meat going back into the village. So everybody gets laid, right? So it's like pretty clearly this is all about mixing it up. And it's not just like for fun because there's nothing else to do. It's also to mitigate the risk of conflict, mm-hmm. right? Because if you get possessive about other people and their sexuality, you're going to have lots of conflicts. And conflict among this small social group, as you say, it's 50 to 150 maximum, right? Because of Dunbar's number, which we can get into if you want. But we can be pretty sure that the groups were never more than 150 individuals. So the worst thing that can happen is you get schisms within that group because you're all depending on each other. You know, some people are better hunters than others. Some people are better at cooking or making bows and arrowheads and all this kind of stuff.
Is that the origin of Dunbar's number? Is that why we only have room in our head for supposedly like 150 close relationships?
Yeah. Dunbar is a biologist at either Cambridge or Oxford. I don't remember which. But he was looking at the brain size of different primates, and he found that he could predict size of the social group of any primate by looking at its neocortex. And so when he looked at humans and made that calculation, he said, okay, it should be about 150. And then they looked at the anthropological record and they found, yeah, interesting, when these social groups grew to more than 150, they split. They tend to split into other groups, not acrimoniously, just because of this.
So we've sort of developed a need for a certain amount of space.
It's like that's as many people as we can keep track of.
And
because
we didn't encounter large groups, that was adequate for the time. And it takes a long fucking time for the human genetics to adjust to their new environment, which is very odd. But it made sense for a million years. For a million years, it totally made sense until the last few hundred.
Right.
And then things just have gotten so strange that the human genetics are essentially the same as those people that are living in the Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some changes. There's a great book called The 10,000-Year Explosion that talks about the genetic changes that have happened since agriculture.
What are the, like, the most significant ones?
Well, eye color, skin color, hair color. You know, there were no blue-eyed people 10,000 years ago.
How do they know that?
DNA, you know, I guess.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow, they've got like 10,000-year-old people DNA, like that old dude that fell in the Iceman.
Yeah.
That fell in the glacier.
Itzy,
That's, if you haven't heard of that story, it's
that's a great
unbelievably
story.
Amazing story, because it's such a rare find. This guy died and he fell in a crevice and the glacier went over him and didn't wipe him out. And that's really rare. Most things, the glaciers were like a mile high plus sometimes. And as they moved across Europe and across North America, across everywhere in the world, I mean, at one point in time, there's glaciers, right?
Well, except most for places, the equatorial regions.
Except for the equator, right? The what they would do is just completely erase everything that's in front of them.
Yeah.
Just houses, trees, just crush everything.
Rivers,
mile
valleys.
High of ice, crush it all. So anything that died back then that got crushed by this slow-moving glacier, we have nothing. We have no evidence of it.
That's, you know, I've got a book idea that relates to this. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about the glaciers erasing stuff like that. What I'd thought, the book idea is, you know, remember how Rumsfeld going into Iraq said there are the known knowns and the known unknowns and the unknown known. You know, remember that whole thing?
I don't remember that.
He gave his press conference and somebody was, you know, talking about predicting what was going to happen. And he said there are the known knowns, the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. So the things you know, things you know you don't know, and the things you don't know that you don't know.
Whoa.
All right? It's kind of an interesting concept.
What a shitty idea to go to war with that.
Exactly. So what I was thinking is write a book about the known unknowns, the things we know we don't know, but that we ignore. Like, for example, in anthropology, archaeology, you're talking about the glaciers wiping out whatever was there, which is absolutely – I mean, they didn't just wipe out houses. They would wipe out the valley, you know, like
flat,
it's gone. Right. Yeah. So it's pretty complete, you know. But the other was like one – you know, people left Africa, the current understanding is about 70,000 years ago and spread out around – or 40,000 years ago. 70,000 years ago is the Toba eruption, which almost wiped out our species. There were – genetic tests show that there are about 3,000 couples, reproducing couples that have the genetic line has continued. So there's this huge bottleneck because the Lake Toba, what is now Lake Toba in Sumatra, was this eruption that triggered an immediate ice age and like feet of ash all over Asia and just like killed everything and triggered winter. It was really nasty. But anyway, the about 40,000 years ago, our ancestors left Africa, the out of Africa, you know, event. And they spread out around the world, but they mostly followed the coastline, right? Which you would, right? Because that's where, like, food's washing up and there's shellfish and you've got good sight lines. So those bears and leopards and shit, you'll see them coming, right? And you can run into the water to get away from them. And, you know, the sort of the water that's not too deep, you don't have sharks, but it's deep enough to keep the leopards away, right?
Right, right.
So that's – and it's easier to walk on the beach, right? So that's – that was the root of the huge exodus that went around the world. But sea levels were about 300 feet lower then.
Whoa.
So the stuff they're finding, you know, the – whatever, the stone tools or the remains that they're finding from 30, 40,000 years ago, those weren't typical at all. The typical people were down on the beach. So those must have been hunting parties or people who were exiled or, you know, whatever. But they weren't at all typical.
That's interesting. So I bet we're missing a lot of the fossils and the little bits of evidence of those people that lived on the beach, which was the majority of the people.
Right. Wow. And that's the stuff that's representative. So it's pretty weird to build your image of a society based on evidence that you know is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what we do because that's all we got.
I can remember really clearly being in college thinking about human history. I don't remember what the subject of the class was, but then I remember being in class and just getting an idea, just for the first time, but in very roughly, of how little we know about just what the fuck actually happened.
Yeah.
When you really start reading books about events, and, you know, I'm reading about, like, I was reading about Custer's Last Stand, and, you know, the account of the Indians' account and the survivors' account, and, you know, trying to piece it all together. I'm like, well, how crazy is it? It's really difficult to piece this together in my head, you know? But today I can watch September 11 happen.
Right.
I can watch a plane hit the tower. I can, like, the way we have recorded things today is so vastly more intricate that, when I look at what I know of, you know, JFK getting shot, what I know of, you know, seeing troops in Vietnam, like this history that is, you know, that I think of, when you look at how little we know about 10,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, and then the idea that the only way you find things is if people died in like a volcano or a mudslide, because you got to get a fossil.
Yeah, or fell into a peat bog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, how many people fall into peat bogs?
Yeah.
How much, you know?
Not enough.
Fucking crazy. What if all the smart people just rotted in the ground?
Like, I'm not going to this fucking peat bog.
There's a whole race of super intelligent people that never went into peat bogs ever.
You know, the first Neanderthal remains that were found were like hunched over and sort of deformed. And so for a long time, the image of a Neanderthal was this deformed, crazy. Turns out that was like a really diseased individual.
Right.
It wasn't a typical Neanderthal.
Isn't it typical, though, to find them very damaged?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
like,
sure.
Especially their spines. And, like, there's a lot of times they're really fucked up.
Oh, a lot of, hunting accidents, and also, like, apparently a lot of wear and tear on the teeth and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah. Neanderthals. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. It's really strange. I've often said that human beings today, it's almost like we're waking up in the middle of history. As a person, as an individual, I've felt that way sometimes watching a documentary or reading a book about something or trying to imagine what it would have been like several hundred years ago. It's like all this has happened already, and it's all real clear. You can sort of piece it together and go, and then we got here. Yeah. And it's like we woke up. We woke up and go, where are we? Where are we? We're on Earth. Okay. How do we get to Earth? Well, this is what we've calculated. Right. And they lay out a piece of paper. Okay, Earth is near the sun, and the sun is surrounded by these other planets. There's another Earth? Most likely. Actually, it's infinite, so every possibility will exist infinite numbers of times. That's the real infinite. So you're like, okay, what? What the fuck are you talking about? And then someone goes, hey, man, I figured some shit out. It's called quantum theory. And you're like, what the fuck are you saying?
Yeah.
And then, dude, there's gorillas. You go to the jungle, they found fucking gorilla. They're big, they're black, they're sort of human-like. Get the fuck out of here. I'm telling you, there's monsters out there.
Yeah.
Like, all that's the 1800s.
Yeah.
I mean, the Western world didn't know the existence of gorillas until like the 1800s.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fascinating when you really think of, like, where we are right now and how much we know about how we got here.
And they didn't know about bonobos till the 1970s.
Wow.
You know, or really start studying them. And they thought they were just a subspecies of chimp. They called them pygmy chimps. Turns out they're so completely different from chimps that they've forced us to completely reevaluate the primate origins of human beings.
Yeah, it really threw a monkey wrench in the whole explanation of why we're so warring and horrible violent.
Monkey
I didn't mean to do that. I swear to God, no pun intended. But for folks who don't know, bonobos are like super sexual. They solve everything with sex, and the only sex they don't have is the mother doesn't have sex with the son.
Man, you did your homework.
No, I've just been fascinated by monkeys.
Yeah.
My whole life.
Apes.
Chimps. Sorry, mostly chimps, but other apes as well. But yeah, apes. I know monkey sounds cooler though.
Monkeys have
gender, transgender.
Yeah. Monkeys have tails. That's I mean, but you're right. Monkey balls is such a good phrase, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I use it all the time, even though I'm always talking about eight balls. But eight ball just doesn't ring.
Yeah. That's why one of my comedy specials was Talking Monkeys in Space, because Talking Apes in Space just didn't
Yeah.
It's missing something.
In Spanish, there's no word for ape, actually.
Really?
Yeah, which makes things complicated in translating our book to Spanish.
So is it just primates?
Yeah.
Just various primate
simians,
names?
Yeah.
Simians?
Yeah.
Simian. That's another good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the monkey wrench that was thrown in, though, to get back to the bonobos, was bonobos are not violent. They don't kill other bonobos. Then they just fuck all the time.
Frans de Waal, the great Dutch primatologist who's responsible for bringing bonobos to public light, to a large extent, he said chimps use violence to get sex. Bonobos use sex to avoid violence. And bonobos are very interesting. And as you know, so people understand, the chimps and bonobos are our two closest primate relatives by far. And in fact, we're more closely related to them than they are to any other primate. So if you go to a zoo and you're looking at a, you know, chimp cage, that chimp shares more DNA with you than he does with a gorilla or an orangutan or anything, right?
Yeah.
So, in fact, Jared Diamond wrote a book called The Third Chimpanzee, where he argued that humans, chimps, and bonobos are basically three subspecies of chimpanzee. We're so closely related. We're more closely related to them than an Indian elephant is to an African elephant, right? We're like super close in terms of DNA. So they're very close to each other. So I think of it as like if I've got twin brothers, they're, you know, closest to each other, but after each other comes me. And I'm equally related to each of them. So the chimp, as you say, is kind of badass, kind of very male-dominated, very hierarchical, kind of conflictive, can be really nasty, and, you know, rip people's faces off in Connecticut. But the bonobo, in 50 years of observation in the wild and in captivity, no one has ever seen a bonobo kill or rape another bonobo.
They don't have to rape. They just fuck.
They don't do it, yeah.
If you want to not get raped, just give it up. Everywhere you look. That's ridiculous. Yeah, we can never live like them.
I'd just like to say I do not agree with that.
No, I'm just saying, in the animal world, that's what they do, right? I mean, that's what they never kill or rape.
You know, rape is very interesting when you're talking about animals. Like, a lot of people say that orangutan sex is rape because it's the male chases the female through the treetops and she's screaming and apparently trying to get away.
Right.
Doesn't dolphins rape?
There is indication of dolphin rape.
Well, dolphins are also involved in mass genocide, infanticide, rather. They kill baby dolphins. They kill them to get the females to breed.
That's typical of a lot of mammals. Lions do that.
Bears
do
that.
Wolves do that. When there's an alpha male, gorillas, when there's an alpha male and he takes over, often he'll kill or if there's a coalition, they'll kill the
young
babies
males,
to
the
get
babies.
Them back, the women back into estrus. Yeah. That's brutal.
Whew.
In fact, that's one of the theories. Sarah Hurdy, who's written widely, she's a very well-known primatologist, anthropologist. One of the theories is that the reason that females are promiscuous in some primate species is to confuse paternity.
Yes.
So that males won't be tempted to kill babies in order to, you know, get women back into – females back into estrus.
And that's the current thinking on dolphins as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Dolphin females are known to be like the sluts of the ocean.
Ah.
They have sex with as many guys as possible. So the guy comes over and goes, might be my kids.
Yeah.
Or they have that bond with that person. Right. What do they establish as the main reason why chimpanzees and bonobos, though so genetically similar, are so different behaviorally?
That's a really good question. There's no perfect theory. The best known theory is that the chimps and bonobos were the same species, and there was a change in the Congo, the route of the Congo River, I think about 5 million years ago, and that's been verified. And so one population got isolated on the south side of the Congo and the other on the north. And the ones on the south became bonobos. The ones on the north became chimps. And the idea, and this is Richard Wrangham at Harvard proposed this idea, is that the chimps on the north were competing with gorillas for some of the same food sources. Whereas there are no gorillas south of the Congo, so the bonobos weren't competing for those food sources.
So they didn't have to get gangster.
Right. But the problem with that theory is that it basically dismisses the assumptions of Darwinian evolution based on Malthus, which is that any population will quickly grow to the point where the food resources are saturated. And so you get competition between individuals for whatever's there, right? he seems to be saying the population of bonobos never grew to the point where they were competing for food, therefore they never had to get competitive. If that's true, that's a radical statement. It happens to be a statement I agree with. I've made the same statement about early humans. I'm saying, hey, early humans were like, you know, these pythons that are introduced into the Everglades. They're like, whoa, there's nothing else here competing for this niche.
Well, it kind of makes sense if you really think about it in terms of how we look at socialism. Because what is the number one complaint from manly men about socialism? It's going to make us soft. Bunch of fucking pussies. You're going to have a bunch of socialists out there. Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is to soften everybody the fuck up, to reduce the need of competition. And to a lot of people, especially people that have adopted sort of advantageous positions, they look at that as like, hey, fucking pussies, you got to earn it. You know, socialism is the, and then the idea, it sort of makes sense if you look at the bonobo community.
Right. Yeah.
They didn't have competition, so everybody just chilled out, and they developed a style of being that's more chilled out.
Right. Right. And there's a great story. I'll tell you, a guy you should interview. I think I mentioned him last time. Robert Sapolsky.
Yes, really. I'm trying. He's in the middle of teaching, though.
Oh, okay. You know, so you've been in touch with him.
Yeah, I'll fly that guy out for sure. I learned everything about toxoplasma, which this fucking podcast is turned to death. They got so tired of me talking about toxoplasma.
Do you tell the same story sometimes?
Sometimes, yeah.
I get tweets from people like, dude, love your podcast, but you told that story three times. Like, how do you keep track?
Well, it's really hard when you have a guest if the guest is not aware of the information, because I don't want to like write it down and say, okay, when the podcast is over, I got to tell you about crazy parasite that changes the way you behave.
Right.
So sometimes if it's a new guest and they don't know about it, I'm sort of forced to. I try to give them the Cliff Notes version of it.
I know about it.
Sapolsky had an amazing video where he detailed and even went into that when he was a med student. They would find cadavers, like guys who died on motorcycles, and there was a disproportionate amount of them that tested positive for toxoplasma.
Risk-takers.
Yes, risk-takers. That the parasite literally gets you to take fucking risks, and that there's a direct correlation between toxoplasma infestation and successful soccer teams.
Wow. So they all have cats in the locker room?
No. Well, there's two thoughts behind that. One is it could be purely that it doesn't cause – it's not an effect. It's just
correlation.
Correlation, yeah. And that it's just you're dealing with people that live in impoverished areas. People in impoverished areas have higher incidence of feral cats. Higher incidences of feral cats is more likely toxoplasma.
Right.
That they're also more desperate and maybe more invested in soccer and more, you know, aggressive in their approach because it means so much to them because it's a way out. You know, much like impoverished people in America, sometimes, you know, they make some of the greatest athletic stories are someone who came from nothing and never wanted to go back to that again and had so much drive. So I don't know if they can absolutely connect the two of them together, but it is a fascinating theory.
Talking about taking risks, as I've gotten older, I've developed this concept I call the fuck it list. Did we talk about this?
No.
So the bucket list is stuff you want to do before you die, right?
Right.
But like I turned 51 a couple weeks ago, and I'm at this stage now where I've got a fuck it list where things I used to think I wanted to do before I die, and now I'm like, yeah, fuck it. You
know? Like what?
Bungee jumping.
No, fuck it.
That's
fuck
definitely
it.
On the fuck it Nay. List. Yeah.
I'll show you a video where a guy bungee jumps and his cord was not long enough, so he slams off the ground in agony, and then with his broken body, yeah, his cord is too long. With his broken body, slams off the ground again. Yeah, and it does it like several times. He's got like a helmet camera on, and the screams that he makes are horrific.
Oh, he didn't die?
No, he lived.
Oh,
because it slowed him down a little bit, but I mean, it just broke him. And then spring up in the air, and then smash back down again. I mean, I don't know if he lived after the video, but he's alive during the video. And it'll cure you of any ideas of bungee jumping.
I hope that wasn't on Tosh.0.
He probably covered it. He's probably got a fucking 10 minutes in his act about it. Daniel Silly.
Yeah,
he's covered everything fucked up that's ever been released on the internet.
He's over there
now
with the Young Turks. He's in the same building.
Oh, is he? I did his show with Doug Stanhope recently.
Yeah.
We went and we did this thing where it was a guy who was a lifelong virgin. And we were trying to give him advice on how to get laid. But that fuck it list, that's a good one for the fuck it list.
Bungee jumping.
What else? Skydiving?
I could be convinced to skydive if it was with some friends.
Fuck no.
Tell him the story.
Oh, My dad was this girl that my dad worked with, skydived all the time.
Yeah.
And every, you know, she always tried to get him to do it. So finally he was going to do it. And then like the week before he was supposed to do it, she jumped and her chute didn't open. And then the reserve chute started tangling with the other chute, and then she died. So it's like my dad was supposed to do it like the following week or something.
All
like
right,
that.
We can add that to the fucking
fuck
that's,
it.
That's all I
and
need.
And she did it. Yeah. She was a pro. It was just, you know, a bad chute.
I did I always forget. Paragliding.
Paragliding.
What's the difference? Parasailing is behind a boat.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, no, I did paragliding, jumping off a mountain.
Oh, my God.
And I did this in India. I took a, yeah, I know. It was really dumb, but cheap. It was cheap, man.
I bet it was. So's your life.
It was in Goa.
Wow.
And there's this German guy on the beach where I was staying, this hippie beach in Goa called Arambol.
Where's Goa?
Goa is just below Mumbai in India. It's on the west coast of India. And it's like this legendary hippie place. Like
really?
Since the 60s, hippies have been going there to chill out on these amazing beaches and smoke hash and, you know, do yoga and shit.
Huh.
So I was there 10 years ago or something. And, you know, we were there for 2 weeks, or no, 2 months on this beach. Like, I didn't wear shoes for 2 months. It was just so great. And so I was looking for stuff to do. And there's this German guy, Uwe, who was teaching, you know, he'd do these classes. And it was like for 10 jumps, $100 or something. So I signed up, and you do the first day theory, and you learn, like, some weird shit. Like, there are these cloud formations that'll suck you up into them. And when you're, like, in the cloud, you don't know what's up and what's down. And it's like, so there are all these things you, like, it's like instrument control. You have to, like, even if you think you're falling upward, you have to pull the shit and fall. And it's like all this weird, horrible stuff.
What is the cloud formation that sucks you up? What's that all about?
I don't remember. I just remember, like, you know, I will not go near those clouds.
Like,
you
know? The Wizard of Oz type of situation?
It was some particular cloud formation that has, like, a really strong updraft. It's like, you know, what's it called on the beach where you get sucked out to ocean? The undertow.
Tide, undertow?
Like, you have to go against it. Against a 90-degree angle, not try to get out of it. Like, you don't swim against the undertow. You swim across the undertow.
Right.
Same thing in this case. Because you get sucked up, your body freezes. And then they'll find you, like, far, far away.
Frozen, somewhere. Solid.
Like Itzy the Iceman.
Itzy the Iceman. Yeah, we didn't finish the Itzy the Iceman story. The reason why this guy didn't get smushed is because he fell into the bottom of this crevice and got covered and turned into essentially
frozen dinner.
Yeah, and a mummy.
Yeah.
A frozen mummy.
Yeah.
So if people are like, what the fuck? You never finished that story.
Do you know Brad Pitt has a tattoo of Itzy on his arm?
Does he really?
Yeah, he's really into Itzy.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Why?
I guess he's just super into Itzy.
Maybe.
Okay. We'd have to ask Brad Pitt. You've got a better chance of getting him on the phone than I do, right?
I don't think he talked to me after all the shit I've talked about his perfume ads.
His new movie looks badass, World War Z.
Yeah, maybe. Those perfume ads fucking do it for me, though. Have you seen them?
No.
Might be the douchiest commercial the world has ever known, next to Steven Dorff's electronic cigarette commercial. Yes.
And
they're
it's not like
right
he,
there.
Like, what, he needs the money?
Well, you know, the only thing that I leave for him is maybe he puts that money to use in some positive way. He's very active. I know
in New Orleans,
he does a lot of stuff, both in America and abroad. So it could be that, you know, they were going to donate a shitload of money to something, and he did it. But it's Chanel No. 5. It's, like, such a dorky. But it's good to bring this up anyway, because I wanted to talk to you about perfume, because it's fucking hilarious where it all came from.
Oh, yeah. Cover the stink.
This is not
the
commercial.
They remade the commercial using Kim Jong-il.
Oh, no, no. Put the actual disappear. No, no. Put the actual one, man. Put the
Dreams
actual
take
one.
Over.
I don't want to see this. You got to see his stupid face while he's doing it.
Poor Brad.
Yeah, well, it's ridiculous. It's one of the most ridiculous commercials of all time, because it's a guy who's a fucking multi-millionaire that you know doesn't wear this stupid, stinky shit.
And his wife has as much money as he does.
Yeah,
I mean, come on.
He's doing a Chanel No. 5 commercial. Somebody has videos of him sucking a million cocks or something.
That's how they did it.
Something. Or they, you know, they promise to cure AIDS. This is it.
When he ends, but we go on. The world turns and we turn with it.
The world turns and we turn.
Plans disappear. Dreams take over. But wherever I go, there you are. My luck, my fate, my my fortune. Chanel number 5.
That's that's a fucking goddamn Saturday Night Live sketch, okay?
Wow. That does seem like a parody of a commercial starring. It also seems like a parody of Tree of Life. Did you see that movie?
Yes. No, I didn't. No, that's the Tom Hanks one, right?
No.
Which one's Tree of Life?
It's with Brad Pitt. It's directed by the guy who did the he's a very interesting director. He does like one movie every 10 years or something. I can't remember his name right now.
This is not the Interconnected Lives. No,
that's the Atlas, the Cloud Atlas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. No, this is like, it is really trippy, though. It's like there's all this, it'll have, Brad Pitt is a father with
Tree
a couple of kids. I'm sure most of your listeners know who I'm talking about. He's a well-known director. He did a really funky movie about the Pacific Theater, World War II, with Sean Penn in it. The guy from Saturday Night Fever, the gay guy, bathhouses.
John Travolta. How dare you, the gay guy. How about the amazing dancer? How about the really talented actor from Pulp Fiction?
You're right.
Like, no, the gay guy that likes
all
to fly.
Those things.
You know that dude that likes to suck dick and soar through the air.
You know, it took you a nanosecond to know who I was talking about, though, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you were playing charades, I would applaud you.
Anyway, yeah. So that seemed like a parody of that movie. There it is. Like the sun bursting, and there's this real slow visuals and...
Yeah, I don't know what the fucking motivation was, but it's preposterous.
Yeah.
Just completely ridiculous commercial.
Yeah.
But the idea behind the perfume itself is very fascinating, though. I don't like it. I've never liked it. I mean, there's like a couple of like oils that girls can put on. I think that smells kind of cool. But generally, I like the way people smell when they're clean, you know?
Right.
And that's why perfume was invented.
Right.
Because people weren't fucking clean. They were dirty, stinky animals that were scared of water.
Right. And that's also why spices were so valuable during those centuries of this, you know, spice was pepper, black pepper was worth more than because the food was rotting.
Yeah.
So they would spice the shit up so you couldn't taste how horrible it was.
Did a lot of people die from like horrible digestive issues back then?
Well, yeah, in the medieval period, a lot of people were dying from all sorts of nastiness related to the nastiness of the food, but also the fact that they were shitting in the street and there's no sewage and everything. But what's interesting, I think this is like cutting edge medical research.
Is that thing still playing in the background?
Got some music in the background there? Yeah, I've heard it since the movie was on just now.
Oh.
What is that?
Oh, nothing.
So your iPad, you fuck?
Jesus, Brian. I thought I was going crazy. Again. Cutting edge medical research. I think it's going to – you're probably tuned into this because of the body hacking and all that. The microflora of the stomach.
Yes.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
So in those days, people would have had really robust intestinal flora to deal with all that.
To deal with the amount of bacteria that you're absorbing in your system on a daily basis, which dogs have. That's why dogs can drink water.
And people who live in India.
Yes.
And, you know, I spent a lot of time – I went swimming in a fucking – lake in India. I don't know what I was thinking.
Do you not have the Science Channel?
No.
Do you not have Discovery? Do you not watch those things where people come back with fucking football-sized parasites growing inside their head?
Dude, this was a long time ago, and I was young and invincible.
What
I
happened
did
to
a
you?
Lot of stupid shit. Nothing.
You got lucky.
And I've been like healthy as shit. You know, I'm like the guy who never gets sick.
Maybe that's what it is.
I think, honestly... When I was traveling a lot in you know, Asia and Latin America and stuff, I took a lot of acidophilus and raw garlic. Talk about body smells, man.
Yeah.
I ate so much raw garlic. And the raw garlic's good. It keeps mosquitoes away. They don't like the smell of garlic, and it comes out through your skin. Keeps women away, too, I found.
Not Italian women.
Yeah.
They just accept it.
Italian men keep the Italian women away. But, yeah, and
you say that, but the balls show a different story.
Are we going to put our balls on the table?
The women's, the Italian balls.
Oh,
larger.
Italian balls.
It's the women's
balls.
Fault that the balls are large, right?
Yeah,
they're the direct.
Well, I think it's more of a species.
Yes,
I mean, there is some cultural, there is evidence that Asian balls are smaller. I almost started talking Spanish there. Quite a bit smaller than black balls, and white balls are somewhere in the middle.
Hmm.
Being very sort of, I don't know if that's politically incorrect to say, but it seems to be true. And my wife has I don't think I told you the story last time. Casilda was here last time. A couple of years into our relationship, one night we were hanging out with a friend in Barcelona, smoking a joint. This friend, he's this funny guy, he was giving me a hard time by giving her a hard time, essentially. And so he was saying, "Oh, Casilda, you're so innocent. You know, you were in medical school and then you were married all these years. And, you know, you hook up with Chris when you're like 40. You know, you're just starting to see the world, you know, as Chris is corrupting you, right?" And he said, you're so innocent, you probably think Chris has a big dick. And she said, "Well, no, I've inspected 1,000 penises." And we were like, "What?" She said, "Yeah, when I was doing that research for the World Health Organization in Africa, I had to inspect 1,000 penises and vaginas." It turns out, I mean, I knew she had done this research, but I didn't know it involved
actually holding the cocks.
You know, yeah. And so we get
gloves or no gloves?
Gloves.
Does it count then? Sort of counts.
Doesn't matter to me. I don't know. I mean, if I were going to be uptight about shit like that, believe me, I'd be in a different business. But the funny thing was, like, he was like, "But you know, she's hot. She was 27 or something at the time." And you're like, "What about erections?" And she just laughed and she said, "Oh yeah, you just flick." So Casilda's sort of like the anti-fluffer. She knows how to bring it down. There's like, you flick right under the head and the erection is gone immediately.
Really?
Yeah. Try it when you get home.
Sounds annoying.
Yeah.
Just, you annoy the shit out of him. But somewhere out there, there's a guy that's like, "It wouldn't stop me. That's what I like. I like a little flicking." So she can prove, you know, she's like one of the rare individuals that's seen the broad spectrum of the races, and she says
African.
It's all.
Well, she's seen 1,000 African.
Oh, it's
penises.
All African.
That was all in Africa.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was all African people.
So it's 1,000 Africans and me.
Oh.
That's her pool.
Oh, yeah. She's not impressed.
I haven't asked.
Don't even ask.
I'm not gonna ask. I don't want to know the answer. I'm not going to ask.
That's funny. What a douchebag friend you have, by the way. I would cut that guy off just the way he communicates. Yeah. Is he a dickhead?
He's a strange dude, actually. He's a jazz musician who grew up and went to college in Philadelphia at Temple, which is 98% black. And he's white, Jewish. He's like a hairy, dark-skinned Jewish guy. He's a big, tall guy. And he talks like an inner city Philadelphia black dude. And
he sounds wonderful.
He's not doing it. He's not racist. Like, he just, mm-hmm. he grew up with these guys and, you know, you learn to like sort of communicate the way your community communicates, but it could be awkward because he would, you know, as much as he would use the N word liberally.
Really?
Yeah. Among like a white crowd and with his black friends who knew him. But then it would get weird if we were at a party or something and he'd be like, "Yo, my.
He sounds like a fucking idiot. What are you hanging out with this guy for?"
This is a long time.
Making fun of you for having a regular sized dick to your wife? What a douchebag. Dropping N bombs. Yeah, bring him to my parties.
Yeah, no.
Sounds like a treat.
He knows.
I love white guys who talk black, too. Oh, one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Can't get enough of them in my life. That's what you really want to go to. If you're really confused about the world, you need a confidant, need someone. Yeah, you got to go to a white guy who talks black.
Yeah. But, I mean, it happens. Hey, look at all these kids with their pants hanging down around their asses and, you know, showing gang signs and, you know, Flickr photos. And what are you doing, Sean?
That pants hanging around your ass means one thing. You don't know how to check leg kicks. Because I guarantee you.
Right. Yeah.
If you'd done any Muay Thai at all, you wouldn't have your fucking
pants.
It's going
to hamper your
style. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah. Someone else is just going to kick your legs. There's nothing you can do about it. Your buckles over your dick. You can't move your hips right. You're not going to get out of the way.
Walk.
You can't walk.
Walking.
Did you say, look at those kids with their baggy pants and their Flickr photos?
Did I?
Those fancy kids with their Flickr
and photos. The gang signs in their Flickr photos.
Oh,
yeah.
The gang signs in their Flickr photos.
I don't even know if Flickr.
Do they really put their gang signs online?
I mean, you see these like kids from Pacific Palisades doing shit. It's like, what are you doing?
You know there is an issue with those kids that grow up in those like really rich places where they want to overcompensate because of the fact that their parents are so not street.
Right. Right.
And they get like intermixed with inner city kids. They get shipped there and then they want to prove their worth. And I actually had a friend who had a kid who went to one of those Pacific Pacific Palisades or Malibu, one of those high schools. And he's like, you'd be fucking amazed at how bad it was. They had to pull the kid out of there because it's constant drugs and violence and chaos and craziness. And they're all a massive amount of kids in those areas that grow up. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it. These people that have a fuckload of money,
yeah,
a lot of them also, they have issues with pills.
Right.
Or they have pills at home, or there's a shallow sort of materialistic vibe to the family, and yeah, it gets distributed to the kids, and then the kids start doing a lot of pills. It's like, it was Malibu or one of those high schools. I really wish I could remember, but they were snorting oxys. It was like a big issue, you know? I've heard about that in Thousand Oaks, too, that they have a problem with girls doing, like there's been quite a few girls that have gotten in trouble for doing OxyContins. You know, they're doing heroin, and they're doing it in high school.
Yeah.
And these are really wealthy neighborhoods, wealthy yeah. areas. But these people are probably never around for their fucking kids.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got enough money to buy a $9 million house, you work your dick off. You know, you probably are not around that much.
Yeah.
I don't see
and the
how
kids are raised by nannies
yeah.
in many cases.
Yeah, especially in those dual career households
yeah.
when your wife works her ass off as well. You're both working your ass off all day, and then you're trying to become parents at night. I mean, it's a fucking grind.
Yeah.
That's a hard grind. You know, if at least a lot of poor people, they involve their families in that grind. You know, they bring in the grandmother or, you know, they live in a neighborhood where there's
right.
a lot of family members nearby and they can sort of take turns taking care of all the yeah. children together, which actually can turn out to be healthier as
yeah.
long as it's not a high crime area.
Well, and that relates back to prehistory.
Yes.
Right? You yeah. know, this whole idea. I mean, Casilda grew up in Mozambique and she talked about, like, you know, at night, nobody worried about where you were. Your parents didn't worry about wherever you were or somebody. There was some adult there taking care of you, being
yeah.
cool, you know. You could eat dinner at somebody else's house and come home later or sleep there. You know, it's like whatever.
It sounds
a community.
So utopian.
Yeah.
But yet not, because nobody wants to live in Mozambique. You know,
oh,
no one here.
Mozambique's happening, man.
You say that.
Oh.
But
it's the Brazil
go
of
to
Africa.
Beverly Hills and say, hey, who wants to go to Mozambique?
Yeah.
They're going to go, bitch, are you crazy? We're not going to move to Mozambique.
Nice beaches.
And you're like, you could just let your kids go. And no one needs to worry. You're like, fuck you. What? You're going to let your kids go at night in Africa?
Yeah.
Are you fucking crazy?
Yeah. Yeah.
No one's going to believe
but
you.
That's the truth, man.
So what is it like? You said it's like the Brazil.
Well, I haven't been to Mozambique.
So you're talking shit.
I'm talking shit. But my wife grew up there. So I hear a lot about it. And she was just there a couple months ago. And she said, and it's like 8% economic growth. It's Africa's booming right now because
wow.
the Chinese are buying up all the natural resources. They're buying up land. It's it's happening.
Wow.
Yeah. And Mozambique's, you know, famous for their amazing beaches and seafood. And it's like a pretty raw, beautiful spot on Earth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Africa's a trippy fucking place, man. The idea of leaving your kids just wandering around in Africa. Aren't there lions in Mozambique?
Yeah, in fact, she had a German shepherd who got eaten by a lion
oh,
when she was a kid.
Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
Mountain lions are scary. Lions, way scarier than mountain lions.
Yeah.
Nobody gets away from the lions.
But you know what kills most people in Africa?
Hippos.
Yeah. Fucking hippos.
And ants.
Oh, really?
Ants are a motherfucker.
That's
dude.
Not a good way to die.
There's a video I saw once of ants eating an elephant, and they were going up the elephant's leg into its ear.
Oh, no.
And they were essentially attacking this elephant, eating it ear first, just going right through the ear, and there wasn't a goddamn thing the elephant can do to stop it.
Oh, man, that's not a good way.
Fuck.
In Alaska, you get that with mosquitoes.
Yeah, I've
They'll
seen that
nostrils.
On TV.
Oh, it's horrible.
I've never experienced it live, but I've watched those Alaska sustenance shows. Have you ever seen those shows?
I saw one or two, yeah, where they put these, like a reality show
No,
thing.
No. These are actually people that live there.
There
are these people that there's a bunch of different ones. There's one of them is called Yukon Men, and the other one's called Alaska, Last Frontier. And they're essentially these people that live in these very small hunting communities,
yeah.
hunting, fishing communities.
Yeah.
And they make no income other than furs that they occasionally get.
Right.
And they have 3 months of summer where they're all just frantically trying to gather up resources. And then they lock down for 7, 8, 9 months.
Right.
And it's crazy. crazy to watch.
Yeah.
And these people in the summertime, they're dealing with fucking swarms of mosquitoes, like aggressive, desperate mosquitoes.
And
that
they're like
know.
An yeah. inch across.
And they know they only have a couple months.
Yeah.
So they just go for it.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when the dusk, when the mosquitoes come out and you can see a swarm coming at you and you're setting up your tent, you know, and like I remember setting up my tent and like every second moving my shirt so they couldn't like get in through the shirt. You know, I had to keep moving the shirt while I'm setting up the tent. And then you get in there and you can hear it's like hail banging against the side of the tent. You can hear them banging on the tent.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they're. They're little helicopters.
What the fuck did people do before they figured out tents?
Well, the Eskimos, I believe that they smeared fat on their skin that would, certain kinds of fat would keep the mosquitoes off them. And they've got all sorts of really clever adaptations. You know, we sort of assume that we would be helpless, but that's because we didn't grow up there and our culture didn't, you know.
Right.
So, and there's, you know who Wade Davis is?
No.
He's an anthropologist. He's written a bunch of books. Really interesting guy. He's like anthropologist in residence at the Smithsonian in Washington. He wrote a book called The Wayfarers, I think was his last book, about traditional, like about how these guys could navigate across the Pacific just looking at the stars and the color of the water and smelling and, you know, whatever. Anyway, one of the stories he tells is about this Eskimo guy, old guy, and the family sort of took the keys to the car away from him, like, you can't go anymore. They were afraid he would go out and die the traditional way when Eskimo people got old, they would just like wander off into the ice and die so as not to be a burden to the family, right? And he was a traditional guy and they were worried that he would take the snow machine out and just die out there somewhere or hurt himself hunting or whatever. So they had this whole intervention. And so that night he goes out, gets out of the house, takes a shit in his hand, forms the shit into a knife blade, spits on it, and the spit is freezing along the edge, and he hones that down so he gets a nice sharp edge with his spit, takes his shit knife, kills a dog or a couple of dogs, and takes their ribs and makes a sled out of it. And with the sinews and whatever other pieces of the dogs, you know, he knew all this stuff from his childhood, hooks up a couple other dogs to the sled, and he takes off into the snow on his, you know, sled with his shit knife.
What? Yeah. Oh, my God. That might be the most insane story I've ever heard.
And they're so clever. You know how they kill polar bears?
I know they take blood and put it on a blade. I know that method. Oh, that was actually wolves. They did that with wolves.
And they,
The wolves would lick the blade and they would cut themselves to death.
Yeah, similar kind of thing. What they would do is they take they'd make a wooden box and they would take a seal rib and sharpen the two ends of the seal rib. And they're pretty flexible, so they'd bend it and stick it into the box, right? And then they'd pour melted fat into the box and let it solidify, freeze. And then they knock it out. So you've got a fat cube with this flexed two-bladed thing inside it. And they'd leave that in the snow. The polar bear come along, swallow it, and opens in the polar bear.
Wow.
And then they just follow the blood drops.
And it would kill them?
Yeah, because internal hemorrhaging.
How long would it take to kill them?
I don't know. I just remember that. I mean, there are stories like that all over the world. You know, the Indian monkey trap. The East Indian monkey trap.
No.
I don't know how interested your readers or your listeners are in this stuff. Yeah. Well, that system is, and this is a good metaphor too. I always remember this one. They would take a, same thing, take a box with a hole about, you know, a little smaller than a fist in the box. And then they put a mango in the box and then hammer it shut and tie it to a tree. So the mango starts rotting. The monkey smells it. Monkey comes along, can stick his hand in and feel the mango, but he can't get his hand out as long as he's holding on to the mango. And they won't let go of the mango. All they have to do is let go, and they can leave. But they've got the mango in their hands, and they won't let go. And so the guy comes around to check the traps. There's the monkey standing there with his hand in the box. Hit it on the head. You got your monkey.
Whoa.
There's a little something about greed there.
That's an awesome story. That is a perfect metaphor, too.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Wow.
Let go of the mango. That's my advice.
Yeah, that should be a t-shirt. Not a bumper sticker, you fucks. Bumper sticker, bad. Yeah. T-shirt, good.
Yeah. Shit knife is a better bumper sticker.
That shit knife is a crazy fucking story. But a guy knife. Killed a dog with a frozen piece of shit. How stupid was that dog?
What are you doing?
Was he sleeping there when this guy came up? I'm like, man, you got shit in your hand? What the fuck are you doing? The
dogs love shit.
Weren't you at Esalen? Weren't you going to talk people into shitting in their hand or something like that? Wasn't that one of your...
I forgot. Did I talk to you about that?
No. I believe you talked to Duncan about it.
Oh, okay. All right.
Duncan's feet?
We were talking about wiping, you know, wiping yourself, and about how weird it is that we sort of like smudge tissue over our assholes after we shit, and then in other countries that we consider these people to be savage, they wash their hand, you know, and they wash their ass with their hand in water, and we're like, that is fucking crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the reason why your left hand is the inappropriate hand to shake hands with in a lot of foreign countries, or to eat
with.
And that they always clean with their left hand.
Yeah.
The shit experiment, did you actually make people do that?
I didn't. No. No.
What happened?
I pussied out.
To fucking Ted again? Did Ted get involved, those bitches? No balls, no shit. You're out of here, pal. Exactly. Do you want in the cult? Yes or no?
They just took down a couple more videos recently.
Oh,
yeah?
Yeah. Of whose?
I forget. I'll find it.
Yeah, but I think didn't they like put the Hancock and Sheldrake ones back up on a different part of the site or something?
I don't think they ever took them down totally. They took them off of one part, and they put it on another part, and they put it up with a disclaimer because they felt like that there was poor science, that there was bad science.
Yeah, pseudoscience. Yeah.
Which, if the scientists can prove, it makes sense. But I think that if you're going to invite someone to talk and you're going to say that they have pseudoscience, I said at the very least you should allow them to have an appropriate response, or allow them a debate. You know, debate them on the merits of this science.
Exactly.
Because I don't know who's right or who's wrong.
Well, the anonymous scientific panel that they use, that's what I think is bullshit. Because they've got a lot of mainstream people who are going to say, you know, whatever, ayahuasca is bullshit. But, you know, let Sheldrake debate that, or in that case it was Hancock, I think he was talking about ayahuasca. You know, or get Andrew Weil, who's an expert in this, or Wade Davis, actually. Wade Davis and Andrew Weil were both graduate students of Richard Evans Schultes, who was probably the most important botanist of the 20th century. He's the one who discovered the plants behind and named the plants behind ayahuasca, and he did his graduate work on peyote. He was a very sort of straight guy himself. He never took any of this stuff, but he discovered dozens of psychoactive plants in the Amazon. He was down there like 20 years.
That's all great. I mean, that's absolutely great for expanding people's knowledge on the subject. But in their particular situation, what was kind of disturbing was that on the website of TED, the accusations that they had, or the reasons that they had for censoring Hancock's work, he asked them specifically, cite where I said this, cite where I imply this. This is not what I said.
Right.
So he was saying that they sort of made this justification that didn't sort of jive with his talk. Now, Rupert Sheldrake, who I think is a bit more controversial in his statements, what Hancock is trying to say is that ayahuasca has had this profound effect on humanity, and it's based on his own actual personal experiences taking it, the experiences of other people that have taken it, the idea being that this indigenous population was not the only peoples that have discovered psychedelic plants, but then in fact there's cave art that details people in altered states of consciousness, also details what they believe to be certain psychedelic substances, and that it's most likely responsible for a lot of art. And I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to say. And if you don't think it's reasonable, the only thing I could say is I doubt you've had any psychedelic experiences, because psychedelic experiences would be incredibly profound to primitive man.
Yeah.
And to state any less seems to me that you're not being honest, you're ignorant, you're either ignorant of to the effects of these things, or you're not being honest about the effects of these things because you're worried about the perception that mainstream academia, that most people in the media, if you start talking about mushrooms, they think you're a silly person. You're a fool.
There it is again, right? Yeah. That's the institution determining the information that's allowed to flow through that institution. Yes. Yeah, I interviewed Charles Grobe a couple weeks ago, who's at UCLA. He's a psychiatrist at UCLA who uses psilocybin, and I think he's also used MDMA in psychotherapy with people who have end-stage cancer to help them. And it's been very effective in helping them deal with the fear of death, the anxiety, because of the sort of transcendent experience that often accompanies these substances. They feel a sense of union with the universe. They lose a lot of that, you know, I'm just my body feeling, which helps them deal with death. So transfer that to what you're saying about you know, hunter-gatherer people or pre-agricultural people around the world or post-agricultural people, Soma in India and a lot of the Elysian fields in ancient Greeks. A lot of these rituals were apparently based on Amanita muscaria, which is a highly hallucinogenic. It's the red mushroom with the white spots.
Santa Claus.
Alice in Wonderland. And,
Santa Claus connection is very famous.
Exactly.
The Amanita muscaria is Soma. Has that been proven?
It's a theory that was proposed by Gordon Wasson, who this is all stuff you can, like, mine Stanley on Saturday. Stanley met the woman, the shaman in Mexico who brought mushrooms into the Western world, Sabina Maria, I think is her name. Anyway, the point I was making is that, you know, here's this guy using this stuff to alleviate the fear of death with dramatic results. And yet, as you say, it's still considered fringe. Although, relating back to our earlier conversation about institutions being in the state of crisis, because people sort of recognize the false values in these institutions, the government's finally allowing research in this stuff.
Really. And it's pretty radical findings. The John Hopkins study on psilocybin and behavioral change, and how it just one trip affected people's behavior and personalities positively 20 years later.
And what Hancock was talking about was specifically the effect of some hallucinogens on addiction.
Yes, and he was using his own personal addiction to cannabis. He had a lifelong history of abuse, as he called it, with cannabis.
And he did say, and sorry to interrupt you, but just the last point on that. I didn't listen to Sheldrake's thing, but I did listen to Hancock's. And he framed the whole thing in, I think, very scientific terms. He said, this may have caused this leap forward in consciousness. This may have been responsible for this and that.
It's absolutely a fascinating possibility to consider. And the only people, in my opinion, that would not consider it are, again, people that have had no experiences with it or people that were worried about the mainstream academic approval. And so they step back and go, oh, this is preposterous.
Right.
You know, no, this is not. It's an incredibly powerful experience. It cannot be denied. And yet, for whatever reason, we've lumped it into silliness. And I struggle
with that. Or criminality.
Or criminality, yes. Even more scary than silliness.
Yeah.
It's really boggled my mind. And the only thing that makes sense is that it's ignorance. It's the illegality of it, which was hoisted onto the American people in the 1970s when they were just trying to, like, control this mass change in culture that had happened so radically between the 50s and the 60s. And we lost a lot of information in that. And we also got a lot of people that were scared about going to jail, scared about losing their jobs. And that all that fear and ignorance clouds the actual argument. It clouds the actual the facts that surround these weird substances. And they're not the cure-all. They're not for everybody.
Right.
But what they are is incredibly powerful experiences. I don't think that can be denied. And to deny the impact of one of the most amazing transcendental experiences that a human being can ever possibly experience, and the fact that it's an orally active thing that grows all over the place where these people absolutely lived, to deny the connection seems like really silly. It seems like you're being a fool and you're ignoring information.
And people all over the world who have access to these plants, wherever you find them, consider them to be the greatest gift of the gods.
Yes.
And then you've got our culture that says, if you get caught with, what, an ounce of psilocybin mushrooms or 100 hits of acid at a Grateful Dead show, you go to prison under minimum mandatory sentencing for longer than second-degree murder.
Yeah.
What the fuck is that?
That's complete pure insanity. That's insanity. But what's even more insanity is to me that people in positions of prominence academically who will talk on these subjects have not had this experience.
Right.
And I'm like, my God, you're children. And it sounds so arrogant to say that.
Yeah.
But someone who's like talking about the negative effects of psychedelic drugs that hasn't had psychedelic drugs will feel like a child after he has a mushroom chip.
Yeah.
You will feel like a fool. You will feel like you are the dumbest person in the world to have ignored that and poo-pooed that. Take 6 grams of mushrooms, get in an isolation tank, and tell me you don't have some regrets for how you looked at that shit before.
Right.
They're not having it. And these are the same people that are pulling these things down. I guarantee you, the people that have had profound mushroom trips are not interested in silencing this Graham Hancock war on consciousness, which originally was called beating, I think, something about the green bitch. He originally defeating the green bitch, which was his addiction
marijuana.
To cannabis,
yeah.
And how the ayahuasca helped him see who he was, his abusive relationship. He's a really fascinating guy because he's not down on marijuana at all. He sort of attributes it to his own abuse of it and like using it as a crutch instead of using it to enhance. You know, so he had whatever addictive issues he had. That's how they've. I mean, that is a real issue with addiction, right? It's like it's not necessarily the substance, and the biological triggers.
Yeah.
It's what's going on with you that makes you obsessed with scratch tickets.
Who's the guy? The British actor, skinny comedian, really funny guy, sleeping with
Russell Brand.
Russell Brand, thank you.
Yeah,
we should play. This is what happens
yeah,
when you get old,
good,
man. I can't remember
the gay guy with the fucking planes.
You give me my brain. I'll just
stick in the air. But massage guy he likes massages.
Russell Brand wrote a thing recently about addiction, and he said something I thought was really wise. He said, "Drugs weren't my problem. Drugs were my answer to my problem."
Ah.
And it's exactly what you just said, and that I agree completely. Drugs aren't causing the addiction.
Right.
You've got an addiction.
Right.
It can manifest in marijuana, in gambling, in jerking off, in a million different ways. And if you locate the problem in the substance, then you'll never solve the problem because that's just a symptom.
But there is a physiological issue that goes along with that
as
well. So, because there's two types of situations. There's the gambling situation where you're sort of getting addicted to the response. But then there's a real like an OxyContin thing. Like I have a friend who had a back operation. And then after his back operation, they threw him on some Oxys. And he was fucked up for a long time. He started getting prescriptions from more than one different doctor.
Yeah.
And he was a mess.
Yeah.
And he just went, into this crazy spiral. And it was absolutely a physiological addiction.
Yeah.
Because before that, he really didn't exhibit crazy addictive or impulsive behaviors. And they were manifesting itself with these
pills.
But
his situation changed with that pain. And the gambler is also getting a chemical high.
Yes.
The brain is releasing endorphins or whatever it is in that case. So, you could argue they're both physiological on some level. But, the point is that there's some – in his case, it was chronic pain.
Right.
In another case, it could be PTSD. It could be, fucked up childhood. It could be whatever.
That is a funny way to look at it. That I never think I don't think I ever looked at it that way before, that it is still a chemical addiction. It's just sort of an endogenous one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I never thought about it that way. I always knocked it off to a behavioral thing.
Yeah. I mean, orgasm.
Yeah.
Those people jerk off in front of the computer all day. There's some.
We're talking to you.
Yeah, that's you, man.
That's you, you motherfucker. You know who you are. That's also sort of it becomes like impulsive. There's not even a reward sometimes. It just, you just sort of repeat a pattern, like you're stuck, you got a scratch.
What hurts when you stop, right?
Yeah.
And that's what addiction is, right? It hurts when you stop. You were talking earlier, we were talking about so-called primitive societies and stuff. You reminded me of this amazing story I read recently where this BBC team went into Papua New Guinea, way back some river. And they were doing a special on these very so-called primitive people back there, no internet, no nothing. And one of the guys, after they'd finished filming, one of the guys said, "Well, we've shown you our world. Why don't you bring me to your world? I'd like to see your world." So when he was back in London, he talked to some people, and they said, well, okay, we'll fund it. That would be an interesting thing, bring these guys into London, you know, and do this whole thing sort of in reverse.
It's
right?
Like a sitcom.
What's that?
It's a sitcom.
Yeah, exactly. Reality show.
These dudes from the
Everything's
jungle.
A fucking reality show.
Stick them in London.
Yeah. So they...
it's Jersey Shore for the UK.
So this guy, his concern was that once this guy saw the modern world, he would never want to go home.
Wow.
So he called up an anthropologist and he said, look, I'm really worried about this. I'd like to do this, but I'm... And the anthropologist said, you arrogant asshole. You really think this guy is going to be so impressed by London that he'd never want to go back to his friends and family and, you know, his whole world and all that? Just calm down. That's not going to happen, right? Trust me. So they fly this guy, a few guys up to London. They take them all around, show them, you know, whatever, all these different things. And one of the things they really wanted to see was something like an archery range. So they took them to this archery range, and they were so fascinated by the arrows that had feathers on the arrows.
Oh, because, the fletchings.
Yeah, their feathers didn't have arrows.
Arrows didn't have feathers.
Their arrows didn't have feathers. So anyway, at the end of this whole experience of being in London, the only thing they wanted to take back was this knowledge of how you put the feathers on the arrow. They weren't interested in
you
iPhones.
Know what the moral to that story is?
What's that?
London ain't Tahiti. That's the moral to that story.
That is the moral.
If they landed in Tahiti.
Far from Tahiti.
The anthropologists would be like, yeah, they're not going on.
Exactly.
Okay? London,
don't even
everybody's
try to get them on a ship.
Drunk, white like paper, eating fish and chips. They're going to want to get the fuck out of there as quickly as they got there.
I agree.
New Guinea's a trip, man, because New Guinea has those seamen warriors.
Yeah.
That's one of the weirdest. I mean, I was going to bring that up earlier when we were talking about these patterns that sort of develop in these tribal societies. One of the most bizarre ones is they take young boys away from their mother when they're like 6 or 7, and they live with men that are the, like, anal father and anal son, like, that's how they call it. And the man just fucks these kids, and they believe that the kid has to swallow and ingest semen into his body in order for him to grow up strong and be a man.
Right.
And that they only use women for procreation.
Right.
And that this entire culture of thousands of people is wrapped around little kids sucking guys' dicks to grow old, to grow strong.
Right.
Fucking, that is one of the craziest ones I've ever written, or read, rather, somehow or another they convinced thousands of people into that one. I mean, what's the origins of that?
Oh, who knows? You know,
no one knows?
There's no way to know. But you find stuff like that
one
all over the world.
One bad motherfucker just likes getting his dick sucked.
Yeah,
just turns
like
into
one pope can just ruin a whole damn religion, you know? Maybe they were missionaries, because, you know, that happened in the Amazon. There's a case of Lizot was his name. He's a French missionary. He was an anthropologist. He wasn't a missionary. He was an anthropologist who studied under the great French Levi-Strauss. And he went to the Yanomami people in Venezuela, and he was fucking all the boys and doing all this crazy shit and telling them that this was the way it worked in the world and, you know. He's still there, I think. He's still alive. It was part of the whole Napoleon Chagnon situation. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Yeah, it's very controversial stuff that happened. Chagnon he wrote The Fierce People, which is the best-selling anthropology book of all time. And he was like a Hemingway kind of guy. And he just published a book recently talking about trying to redeem his reputation. Because it turns out, like, what he did was he went to the Amazon in the late 60s. Or the Orinoco, really, which is a tributary of the Amazon in Venezuela. And he was studying the Yanomami people. And he wrote a thesis and calling them the fierce people, saying that they killed each other at such high rates. And this justifies this Hobbesian view of the origins of human violence, that we're really nasty. And so we need these, you know, governments and religions to keep us in check. And, you know, it's very political, right? But he was just saying it's anthropology. But it resonated with the culture. Vietnam was happening, and there's all this discussion of why are we violent? Is it our nature, or is it institutional? You know, the whole hippies versus the institution debate. So anyway, he wrote this book, and it was a huge bestseller, and he became super famous. turns out that when he went into this area, he brought lots of machetes. And these people didn't have lots of machetes. They didn't have metal tools at all. So he brings in the machetes and he starts giving the machetes to certain groups in exchange for their cooperation. And his research was on genealogy, so he needed to get the names of ancestors. But it turns out that the Yanomami, it's a great taboo to ever say the name of a dead person. So what he would do was say, okay, I'll give you this machete if you tell me the names of the father and grandfather of that guy from that other village. So he would bribe them to get this information. But that's a great taboo to say the names of that guy's father or grandfather, right? So then he would go to the other village, and as a way to confirm whether the information was correct, he would say, so-and-so over there said your father and grandfather were blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And if they got really pissed off, he knew it was correct. So that would confirm his information. Then they would break, they would have all these wars, and they'd kill each other with these machetes. And then he reported back saying, oh, the Yanomami are very fierce, destructive, you know, warlike people, and this is the origins of humanity, and yada, yada, yada. Fucking bullshit, man.
Wow.
Complete bullshit.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So there's a book called Darkness in El Dorado that came out a few years ago. It was a big bestseller and exposed a lot of this stuff. And it also went further and accused him of genocide, him and this other guy, Neil, for it accused them of using a vaccination program as a way to sort of test immune responses. And
ugh.
That appears to be false. That appears not to have been true, right? But the other stuff with the machetes and sowing violence and all that, and then reporting that they're
and the molestation from the other guy. That's all true
the other
as well.
Guy. Yeah, yeah, that's true
what
as well.
What a fucking group of victimized people trying to just get along, and these white people come along and fuck everything up again.
Yeah, and they even I write about them in Sex, the situation in Sex at Dawn, and they even the Yanomami have a special word called, I think it's anthro, which means like a crazy, destructive white person, you know? Like, so he's not even allowed ever to go back to Venezuela. He's barred from the country.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why I was talking about that. I don't remember what tangent.
It doesn't matter. It's just the distortion of, you know, the our image of these people and how these crazy cultures can erupt. And that might have been missionaries that caused these guys to blow all these kids.
Yeah. I mean, and by the time, oh, that's what
it
was.
All these kids blow them, rather.
I mean, you see these interesting sexual practices all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of stuff's, you know, that one, I was talking about that one last night at a cocktail party in Venice, actually. I was talking with this gay guy, and we were talking about how, you know, we think we know what it means to be gay. But you look at a culture like that and you say, well, are they gay? They consider it to be normal sexual development, conventional. You know, that's what you do. Or the Maasai. The Maasai, you know, the herdsmen who drink blood and milk in Kenya, they have a similar sort of thing where the younger boys go out on these long, you know, when they're out with the herds for weeks or months at a time, they go out with the older boys. And the older boys will have sex with them. Not anal sex, but they'll put their penis between the thighs of the younger boy.
That was how the Romans did it as well.
Right. Yeah. There's a name for that. I can't remember the word, a specific word for that.
Either way, it's still gay. Let them know.
Well, that's the thing. They would say it's not, because then they get older, they marry a woman, they have kids. That's just normal growing up.
Normal fuckery. Yeah. Now, I think once you know what kind of a damaging effect that has on the young boys.
But it doesn't. That's the thing. If it's considered normal, it doesn't. Mm,
don't knock it until you thigh it.
Oh, how dare you.
Oh.
How dare you.
Oh.
He was so proud of himself right there.
Yeah, he was saving that one up.
Been hanging out with Hinchcliffe too long.
The idea, though, that it's not going to have an effect is only based on the fact that they're going to do it to more young boys and they're not going to complain. And that's one of the weird things about sexual abuse is that it sort of re-manifests itself in the victim. And they sort of start to become the accuser. I mean, they also become the perpetrator.
In fact, a guy I was speaking to recently who identifies as gay, he said to me, I don't think I was born gay. I think I'm gay because I was sexually abused as a child by my stepfather from the time I was 3. And we got into this whole discussion of how there's a term, erotic plasticity, and how different it is for men and women. in men and males of other mammals, there seems to be a developmental window where we imprint something. And that window closes, and if you got an imprint, that sticks with you for life, which is why virtually all fetishists are men. Right. There are a lot of men who will say, well, I can't get off unless, you know, there's latex or she's wearing red high heeled shoes or she's got this or that. Right.
Right.
You know, women don't say that. Like women, you know, they're much more flexible and they adapt to the situation. So the idea is that if during that window you're imprinted with male-male sex and pleasure involved with that, then you could sort of like have that as a fetish, even though you were born, you know, your sort of genetic components or your brain development or whatever, there are different theories, is heterosexual. So they're different, according to this idea, there are different ways to be gay. You could be born gay or you could be gay as a fetish in a way, you know. But anyway, related to what you're saying about the trauma, there's research showing that what really causes the trauma is the shame generated by the culture, that boys who are what we would call sexually abused or girls who are sexually abused at a young age, if there's not pain involved, right, if it's inappropriate touching or whatever, the trauma comes about when they're told that was really bad and they're told that that's a horrible thing that happened. It doesn't necessarily come about from the experience itself. And I don't mean this as to justify anything or give anyone cover.
But aren't there a variety of different types of experiences?
Sure.
I mean, are these consensual and just innocent, or are these actual hold you down rape?
Yeah, pain? That's what I'm saying. If physical pain's a whole different thing.
Okay.
If it's just two little kids diddling each other.
Right.
You know, some mothers would say that's abuse. That's a horrible, oh my God, what happened? The best thing to do is just say, hey, nothing happened. You know, it's no big deal.
Right.
And there are psychological studies showing that the lasting effects are negligible unless it's framed as, oh my God, what happened?
That completely makes sense.
Yeah.
As does the framing thing. The framing thing completely makes sense as well, that there's like something happens in their life and they just get imprinted. And that's, I mean, otherwise, why would so many abuse victims become abusers themselves? You would think that like... the last thing you would do is to repeat that. Like, oh my God, that's the thing that fucked you up and ruined you. You would say like, man, I would never want to do this to another person.
Right.
And that would be how we would evolve. So it seems like there's like a hitch in the developmental process that allows weird things just to be accepted and become the standard.
Right. They become eroticized and associated with pleasure. And so you try to relive them later. There's a great experiment with, it happened in Scotland, I think, where they took – one year they had like a herd of goats and a herd of sheep. And so they took all the babies, all the baby goats, and they put them with the sheep. And they took all the baby sheep and put them with the goats. So they were raised thinking they were the other species, right?
Wow.
So all the goats grew up around the sheep thinking I'm just a weird-looking sheep, right, and vice versa. So they waited till they got sexually mature and started having sex, and then they switched them back. And what happened was that the males refused to have sex with their own species because they had learned that, the male goats had learned, like, I fuck sheep.
Right.
And the male sheep, no, I fuck goats. The females were like, yeah, whatever. You know, they just sort of, like, went with it. But the males refused. They were stuck with it because they were imprinted, and that was it.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
What the fuck evolutionary purpose does that play?
Who knows? That's a good question. I don't know, but it's a common mistake, I would say, and I'm not saying just among people reading books for the first time, but among experts, there's a mistake of thinking that everything has an evolutionary function.
I say, like, sometimes it could just be the tide went that way, and that's what happened.
Right. And there's something Stephen Jay Gould, the great evolutionary theorist, called spandrels, which are things that look like they have a function, but they're actually sort of a side effect of something else. Mm. You know, like the chin. You know, why did the chin evolve the way it did? Well, we have a word for this thing we call the chin, but it's not actually a thing. It's where the two jaw bones fuse. So it exists as a linguistic concept, but not necessarily as a biological concept.
Mm.
So they're weird, you know, they're murky waters you can get lost in when you're looking at evolutionary stuff. And you always, I advise people, you always, if you say, what's the evolutionary function of that? Be clear on what that is and that it actually would necessarily have an evolutionary function, you know?
I've always been fascinated by why at the same time, all over the world, people who are human beings or who can breed with each other but have such incredibly varied ways of behaving.
Yeah.
And that this has always been this way. I'm really into this Dan Carlin podcast recently. He's got this podcast called Hardcore History, and he does this really detailed history of the Mongols over like five episodes. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just fucking craziness. The way these people just took over Europe and just conquered, and just the madness and the how they were so different from anyone that existed at that time, and that they were so extreme and intense. Yeah. But at the same time, they lived somewhere in the Amazon. There were a bunch of people doing ayahuasca and eating fish, and you know, and polyamorous people and. It's amazing that this all took place all along, you know, during the same time.
Do you ever read The Travels of Marco Polo?
No.
You know the story?
Yes.
Yeah. It was like 1400s or something like that, or 1300s. And he went to – he was with the Mongols.
Wow.
And he walked all across Asia on the – they call it the spice route with his uncles. And, yeah, he was with, I don't know if it was Genghis Khan or Kublai Khan or which of the Mongol kings it was. And along the way, talking about interesting people, he stayed with the Mosuo people of southwestern China, who still exist and apparently still have this very interesting marital, well, not even marital, sexual behavior, where both men and women are completely autonomous sexual beings. You have sex with whomever you want. There's no slut shaming. There's no shame involved with multiple partners, whatever. You do what you want. When a girl becomes sexually mature, she gets her own room called a flower room that has a door that opens into the central courtyard of her mother's house where she lives, and also has a door that opens into the street. And so that girl from, you know, 13, 14, whatever sexual maturity, she can let anyone she wants come in and spend the night in her room with her. The only rule is he can't be there for breakfast, right? So no, nobody's invited for breakfast. Get out by sunrise.
Huh.
But she can sleep with whoever she wants. Then what happens when she gets pregnant is that the child is cared for by her brothers and her sisters. So as a man, your paternal responsibility is to your sister's kids, not to your biological child. In fact, biological fatherhood is a non-issue in this society.
That's amazing.
Yeah, really interesting society. It's the Marco Polo stayed with them, and he wrote about them. And he thought, typical Italian, right? He thought that like he was screwing these women behind the men's backs, and you know, play.
Marco Polo was getting some.
He was getting some.
He just thought he was slick.
He thought he was a cool guy, but it turns out the women were just like, "Yo, foreigners."
That's funny.
Yeah.
It is amazing when you think about the variables. It's amazing when you think about the variety of different cultures that evolve simultaneously all over the world, and how. I mean, is it their environment that causes that, or is it this? Is it missionaries move in and give them machetes and talk about their ancestors? I mean, the various things that happen are so. And I know I confuse those two stories, the missionary and the researcher.
But it's all,
like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and smallpox comes in. And,
oh yeah,
and then you got the ice ages, and you know all.
Yeah,
but I tend to be a materialist. There's a book called Cultural Materialism by Marvin Harris, which is a great book. And he wrote a more popular book called Cannibals and Kings, which covers some of the same stuff. And he looked at things like, why are some societies cannibals and others aren't, right? So you've got the clash of European societies and the Aztecs and the Mayan and all that. And so, you know, you can't say the Europeans weren't bloodthirsty, you know, crazy killers. They just didn't eat what they killed, the people they killed, whereas the Aztecs were killing the people or eating the people they killed. Why is that? Or why on some South Pacific islands were the people cannibalistic and others they weren't, right? So what he did was he did a materialistic analysis. And what he found was that without exception, in the societies that were cannibalistic, there was no other source of protein that didn't compete with humans for the same food. So, like, they didn't have pigs, right? Pigs will eat stuff humans can't eat, right? So you can raise pigs without feeding them your own food. But dogs, you feed them stuff you would eat because dogs eat meat, right? Mm-hmm. So in Mexico, there was nothing that they could raise, no animal that could be domesticated that they could raise for meat. And so that's why they ate the dead people, because they were protein starved.
Wow.
Right. And then he applied that same thing to the different islands in the South Pacific, and he found the same thing.
And American Indians, Native Americans in the harshest climates were the ones that were tending towards cannibalism, like towards the Great Lakes, like the Native American people from the Great Lakes area.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that there's the stories of them cannibalizing people.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also have
harsh
to look
environments.
At yeah, in midwinter. Yeah, yeah, sure. But also in that kind of thing, you want to look at ritualistic cannibalism versus, like, okay, dinner time, you know?
Yeah.
Because they had some interesting torture ceremonies as well in those Canadian Great Lakes, Iroquois kind of. It was an honor to be tortured to death.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
The Steve Rinella guy that I was telling you about his book, Meat Eater, he told me some crazy stories about the people that lived like off the Missouri River, like in Montana, and you know, the trappers and all these different people that have like these conflicts with the Indians and how they would kill them. And there was a lot of cannibalism going on, a lot more than I would have ever imagined. It's because that's not really something that gets brought up in high school history, or, you know, they don't really tell you, oh, by the way, Indians occasionally used to eat people.
Yeah, as did the settlers, I'm sure. You know, the Donner Party.
North America itself is one of the most spectacular examples of how quickly things can change.
Yeah, you're right.
If you stop and think about North America just 1,000 years ago, just 1,000. Anywhere in Europe, 1,000 is like, there's still people, man. There's still nuttiness. There's still...
I've hung out in bars that were more than 1,000 years old.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. What is the oldest bar in like London? Isn't there like a bar that's from like the fucking...
Yeah, I don't know. Barcelona, I know, I could take you to them.
How old
is
it?
Several of them. Well, the oldest continually open bar is from the 1700s. It's Amiral, Bar Amiral. I've been there many times. But the place I'm thinking of when I said 1,000 years old, it's a bar down in the Gotico section of Barcelona, where one wall of the bar is a Roman wall from the original Roman building that was there. So
Holy
you're like leaning up against
shit.
A Roman wall drinking your beer. It's really cool.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Not America.
And that's 2,000 years old. You know?
1,000 years ago, no Manhattan, no Los Angeles, no Chicago, no Atlanta. Just stop and think of that alone. Just what radical changes to the landscape we've seen over the past few hundred years. Forget 1,000. Yeah. 1,000 years ago, you wind up in New York on a boat, and what are you looking at? Looking at some fucking wooden shacks that are huddled up together eating beaver pelts?
Yeah.
The fuck are you looking at? You know? This thing has changed so fast.
I met a guy at a wedding a few years ago who was like one of the world's leading experts on seashells. Sounds kind of boring, right? But we ended up talking about wampum. And he told me something I'd never read anywhere, which, you know, wampum, right? It was made from seashells. This was like the money.
I know the name, but I don't know.
It was money.
It was money,
that Native Americans used in the Northeast, right? When the Dutch first arrived, and you know, the very early days of New York is what reminded me of it. It was made from a particular type of seashell that only grew in a certain area. So like all currencies, it had a very restricted source, you know, like gold or whatever, beaver pelts or whatever it was. That's, by the way, you know, that's why $20, that's deerskins. That deerskins were used as currency in the colonial period. Yeah,
oh,
that's
why
we say $20. Yeah, but anyway, so the wampum, they'd make these belts of wampum that you could use to buy and sell things, right? So the Dutch, clever bastards that they are, figured out how they were making this wampum and what sort of seashells it was, and they learned to cultivate that particular mollusk. So they were basically printing, you know, counterfeit wampum.
Wow.
So they didn't even just rip off the Indians when they bought Manhattan. They bought it with fake money.
Holy shit.
Fake Indian money. Yeah.
That's hilarious. They bought it with seashells.
Yeah.
Imagine how much a condo goes for now. And just think that the whole thing went for seashells.
That's a lot of seashells.
That's a change in the real estate market right there.
You know what I love? I lived in Manhattan for a few years, and last year I was there. I worked in on a construction site. And since we're just talking randomly interesting things here, the guy, one of the laborers on the construction site explained to me why the buildings are really high in Midtown, and then they go down, and then they go back up, and they're high again down in Wall Street in the financial district. You know, if you look at Manhattan mm-hmm. from New Jersey or from Queens or Brooklyn or whatever, I always thought that was just like, you know, what you're saying is like there are all these strange things that come together, whether it's finance or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever happenstance somebody just wanted to randomly. Build here or there. Turns out, no, there's a logic to this. And the logic is that the rock, the ground, the geological rock comes up near the surface at Midtown, and then it goes way down again and then under, you know, Soho and the Village and all that. And then it comes back up close to the surface at Wall Street. So to build a really tall building, you have to drill, anchor it into the rock. So you can't do that where there's a lot of dirt. You'd have to like dig down so far to get to it, you'd like excavate the hole.
Oh.
So you can only build a 50-story building where the bedrock is close to the surface and you can anchor it into there, right? So it's stable.
Mm, totally makes sense.
So what you're seeing when you look at that skyline is like an echo of the geology of the island.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That is absolutely fascinating. It brings me up to this quote I was going to bring up earlier when you talked about Marshall McLuhan. A lot of folks don't know who Marshall McLuhan was, but he said a lot of amazing things. And one of the things he said, I think it was like in either the 50s, I think he said in the 50s, he said that man becomes the sex organs of the machine world.
That's beautiful.
That's the craziest statement ever. Yeah. If you stop and think about how premature it was or how precocious it was to say that in whenever he said it, 1950 or 1960.
Yeah.
And look at what's going on now with our symbiotic connection to technology, the true machine that's taking over.
I'm writing that down because I'm going to use that thing. Man.
I've thought about that so many times without even having read his quote, but I wasn't able to put it so eloquently in my head.
Yeah.
That they look like a life form. I mean, I have skeletons in my garage. It's an old Mac, old shitty fucking, like, tan thing with a stupid rainbow apple on it. I have one of those things. It's, like, really old. And it's hilarious. I look at it. I'm like, this is like a dinosaur. So might as well be like a dead dinosaur, a dead, useless thing. And now, you know, we don't have dinosaurs anymore. Now we got chickens. You know, now we got whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it really does seem like.
Yeah. I wrote an article about the future of sex for this European, called the European Magazine. It's, I guess it's a German magazine, but they publish in English as well. They asked me to write this thing a few months ago, and I could have used that McLuhan quote. That was really good. But I said, like, basically, the way I see the future of sex is peeling off in two different possible directions, depending upon whether there's world collapse or not. And if there's not, I see us, as many people do, merging with machines, what do they call it, the singularity, but also in terms of sexuality, that, you know, now we've got fleshlights, but in a few years, we're going to have holographic images. We're going to have, like, the technology is always driven by this sexual hunger. There's a book called The Erotic Engine, where this guy argues that every communication advance was driven by money coming from erotic energy, you know, VHS tapes and then DVDs and the internet, like all the first money's coming in for porn, you know, even photography.
First time adapters, like HTML5 and all that. As soon as people realized that the iPhone wasn't going to go with Flash and that HTML5 seemed like the future when it comes to animated things online,
right.
Porn went right to it.
Sure.
You know, whereas a lot of websites, you go to it on an iPhone and it'll show you the Adobe thing, not supported and not porn. They figured out right away
how to. They're on the ball.
Yeah, they got to make it so you can watch people fuck on your phone.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing, though, that is sort of, again, in the closet? It's sort of a background sort of reality.
Yeah.
Like all the banks in Miami being funded by cocaine. It's right. Like everybody knows it, but nobody talks about it. Right. You know, why is there so many banks in Miami? Because that's where the fucking cocaine came from.
Right.
Why is technology moving towards HTML5? Why is, you know, what is online streaming technology? Where's its roots? Its roots are in people watching people fuck.
Right.
That's where they got it right. down. That's where they right. got really good at it.
Yeah, and that's where the money is.
And that, that might, I mean, what percentage of that was responsible for the development of the CD-ROM? What percentage of that, you know, how much? I would like to know.
Yeah, check out the erotic engine. That's he talks about all that, yeah.
Because before the internet came along, I mean, how many people bought movies as opposed to how many people bought dirty movies?
Yeah.
What was the share of the market? It's a yeah. big fucking chunk, right?
Yeah. Well, in the cinemas, you know,
yeah.
the porn.
That was another thing from your book that I found completely fascinating that I didn't think about was how we have this idea of corporate America not profiting in porn, but how, in fact, like chains of hotels yeah. are like the biggest porn providers in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're making huge proportion of their profits from yeah. those on-demand movies.
Last
yeah.
week when I was in San Diego, I literally went through the whole entire list of porn because they were so funny titles. It was probably 300 titles that they just had there.
Mm-hmm. And they're selling for like, what, $20 or something?
I think $10.
Whatever it is. I mean, that's pure yeah. profit at a certain point. You know, and once they pay the licensing fee off or whatever it is. So them and... You know, what was the other example you had of people that were profiting off of porn that you would not expect?
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember the corporate thing you're talking about. And I think the corporation in question might have been Coca-Cola or somebody owned by Mormons or something. It was some, like, really conservative public image, but they were the biggest supplier to the hotel chains. And there
Chick-fil-A.
Were...
That would be hilarious.
That would be
biggest
it's only
porn.
Anal.
Yeah.
Only Chick-fil-A is only into chickens and dicks and asses. That's it.
The other day I interviewed Nina Hartley from my podcast. She's really interesting.
I had a runaway from her. She was on Kevin Pereira's podcast, and as soon as she was talking about how she only has sex with gloves on, I was like, bitch.
Yeah.
Did you say that?
You lost
weird.
Me.
Yeah.
You lost me, bitch. I gotta go.
She only has sex with gloves
She's
on?
All into fisting and fingering and assholes and pussies, and she doesn't want fingernails. And I mean, it makes sense,
yeah.
but it's because she's a goddamn professional. I mean,
she's
got this clinical snap rubber glove approach to sex.
But she's also a nurse.
And she also has a fleshlight.
She has her own fleshlight.
Oh, that's right. She's got her own.
It resembles
model.
A missile hitting a large mammal. what you would get. Nice lady. I mean, look, she's an old freak.
She's very
she's an
smart.
Old, yeah, she is smart.
Super smart.
She's an old hippie freak. That's what she is, you know?
Yeah.
But I gotta. That's where I got to walk away. When we start talking about, I only have sex with gloves on. Okay, you lost me.
I just put a little bit of gold bond on it, and then I rub it with my
She's
gloves.
Not that old, dude. You made her, like, pass. She's something past a MILF, though, right? It's like
we talked
mature.
About that. Yeah.
She's
yeah.
in a new category.
She's 53, 54, somewhere in there.
Still yeah. fucking throwing down.
Throwing down. She's an educator. She's good. You're talking about gloves, man. A friend of mine told me this story. He was with a woman who's polyamorous, all right? And so he you know, whatever. They were going out to dinner. And he gets a text from her a few hours before dinner saying, look, I just want to be upfront about this, as polyamorous people often are. My agreement with my partner is, what was the detail? The agreement is no intercourse. So we can do whatever else, but no intercourse, right? So he's thinking, well, geez, I thought it was just dinner, right? So I guess
right.
that's pretty good news. I mean, it
right.
seems like everything else is on the table, you know? So then they end up back at her place, and she says, oh, sorry, the rule changed a little bit. Now it's like no genital contact. So they're making out, and she says, okay, sorry. You know, my boyfriend says no genital contact, right? So he says, okay, that's fine. So then... She says, wait a minute. They're getting all hot and heavy. She says, wait a minute. She goes to the other room. She comes back in. She's got these black latex gloves on. And she starts giving him a hand job. Because, like, apparently with the gloves, there's no contact.
Right.
And then she gives him a dildo. So there's, like, all this crazy stuff is going on. And
right.
He told me the story. He's like, this was so far beyond what I would have, you know,
hoped
anticipated. Exactly. And it got really freaky because of these rules. And of course, it made me think about drugs. You know, like, hey, if coca leaf is illegal, well, then they're going to make cocaine. You know, if grass, if you can't just grow grass in your backyard, then you're going to get hydroponic, you know, super grass. It's like you make these rules, you know, like hard liquor, right? Prohibition is what started gin and all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. right? So you make rules to try to contain a natural human appetite. And what happens is it gets explosive, right? Just like a bomb. The bomb needs the containment to be explosive. Otherwise, it's just nothing.
Well, it's a natural human inclination that I can see loud and clearly with my kids. When you try to keep kids from doing things, they automatically are like, why the fuck should I listen to you? That's what I want to do. They get angry. It's like it's a natural human response because all of our entire history of humanity has been people trying to dominate people, people trying to control people. So our natural thing is to resist control. It's why the biggest sluts always have like super religious parents.
There you go.
Jesus Christ, folks. Is it that easy? Does Dr. Christopher Ryan have to explain it that easy? Yes.
Although Nina Hartley's parents, interestingly, were communists who were blacklisted in Berkeley. Really interesting.
Yeah, she's an old hippie.
Yeah.
She's an odd case.
She's an odd case.
Yeah. She's one of the rare ones where you always connect human like girls who are into porn or get into that, you always connect it with some sort of an abuse.
Yeah.
You know, some human aberration.
Right.
But now, with her, she seems like just a crazy old hippie freak.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem dirty. It seems like she's having fun. Like, you know, it's weird.
Yeah. No, she's an interesting person. I enjoy
it. What is the weirdest thing you've gotten out of this study of human sexuality? Because your book is incredibly enlightening, and I think Duncan's his definition of you as a shame exorcist is really a perfect one, because it puts so many things into perspective, and it makes so many weird patterns of behavior that we follow. It sort of enlightens you on the origins of them. But what is like one of the weirdest things that you found in this pursuit?
Well, yeah, there's so many, you know, obviously these things pop up in every conversation, but I think one of the most memorable and moving in a way was when I went looking for the first documented case of key parties and, you know, partner swapping and that sort of thing in modern America, not these sects in the 19th century, but 20th century stuff. I thought it would be you know, some commune in Berkeley with a bunch of hippies and Hendrix posters and, you know, whatever, waterbeds and, you know, that kind of thing. And, but it wasn't. It was World War II fighter pilots in the Pacific who had the highest fatality rate of any branch of the military in World War II. 25% of them died in action.
Whoa.
When they were back on base, I guess in Hawaii or the West Coast, they had key parties where they and their partners would come to these parties, put the keys in, you know, like in the ice storm. I don't know if you saw that movie, great movie. And randomly sleep with each other's wives or girlfriends, right? And, you know, these are all like super, you know,
macho,
genetically, good-looking dudes, all alpha males, obviously. And the women they were with were hot. So I don't think anyone was worried about, you know, pulling the short straw out of the, you know, the short key. But, you know, I thought, well, okay, sure, these guys are facing death. They want to get it while they can, right? But then in the interviews I read with the survivors, what they said was, yeah, okay, we were young, we were strong, we were getting laid, but we could have gotten laid anywhere. You know, we could have gone to a bar and gotten laid. We did this because we wanted those other guys, we wanted our buddies to love our women so that if I die, I know these guys will take care of her.
Whoa.
Because they love her. Because they've been with her. And they know her, right? It's like it moved me so much to read that, because a lot of the accounts from the Amazon are the same. These guys are facing a difficult life. You know, you can go hunting one day and you're the huntee. You know, things can go wrong really fast. So you want people to love each other, not exclusively, because then they take care of each other. They take care of each other's kids. They share their food. They, you know, they look out for each other. And that's really the essence of humanity.
Have you explored the idea that the opposite trend that we are finding ourselves in now, where people are gravitating towards monogamy, at least culturally, at least on paper,
yeah,
that this this move towards that ideal is because we're safer? Is because we're more likely to be protected. We don't need these. And sort of it's a natural inclination, yeah, to move towards like a deeper bond with one individual person.
I don't know that I'd call it a natural inclination, but you know, I tend to see it more as a byproduct of institutional and economic, right, forces.
I see that as also being natural. And I know it sounds very contradictory.
No, I
hear
you.
When I look at wolf behavior, I don't take our crazy, fucked up, weird behavior and not think that it's natural. Even though there's consciousness involved and choices involved, there's something about the pattern of human behavior when I look at it as a whole where I see it's kind of arrogant to assume that this isn't natural. It seems that almost everything is natural.
That's the thing. It depends how you define natural, right?
Right.
I mean, you could, if you take a real global perspective, you could say, as I tend to think of it, that we are not, we're the ants in the anthill.
Right.
And the anthill is what's evolving. And that's the sort of the location of the selection. In other words, as individuals, we think we're what's evolving. But I think what's evolving is societies, corporations, these institutions that include us. And they don't give a shit if we're happy or not.
Right.
This larger being that we're a part of.
And as we fuel them with electricity, with commerce, with whatever, they literally act like a life form. The same way as technology, like Marshall McLuhan said, we are the sexual organs of machines. Well, as we fuel the desire for new laptops, we keep that alive.
Right. And you know, when Mitt Romney said, corporations are people, my friend. I don't think he was thinking in these terms.
Right.
But they're not people, but they're living beings.
They have a stake in staying alive.
Right.
They have a vested interest in success.
And if they have to step on us to do it, they'll do it. You know?
How fucking crazy is that? And they can get people to do it for them.
Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, that was the whole Frankenstein myth. And it's happened.
Yeah.
You know, don't fear it. Don't, you know, Hal in 2001.
Right. Sure.
It's here. It's been happening for quite a while. Monsanto doesn't give a shit if they produce food that kills us.
No.
As long as they've cornered the market.
Well, they also produce DDT and Agent Orange.
Sure.
So
it sells, right?
they've been making fucked up choices for a long time.
You know what? I told that story about the pilots in San Diego. I was giving a talk down there, and this guy came up to me after, and he said, "I was a fighter pilot in Vietnam. Same thing. Different war, same thing."
Wow. So it's a natural behavior pattern.
Apparently, it's a culture among fighter pilots. That that they're facing death, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I found it. I've done a lot of research in hospitals, and I found a very amplified sexuality in hospitals among doctors.
Sense. Yeah,
because they're facing
cops
death.
As well.
Cops, yeah, sure,
yeah,
sure. Anybody who's on the edge,
and Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan swings.
He's fight that MMA fighter.
No, he's not. He's just interviewed at the airport, and he just said something silly. Everybody blew that out of proportion. Hulk Hogan, he was a wife swapper.
Yeah,
it was on
a
video.
Lot of guys. The coach of was it the New York Jets or the Giants? Ryan. There was this, did you hear about this?
No.
It's this controversy because there were pictures on the internet of him, his wife, and another dude. And the wife was like either naked or in lingerie, and the other dude was sucking her toes.
Oh,
or something.
Jesus Christ. That's where I check out.
that's when you want the gloves.
We're weird about that, man. We're real weird about that. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to just see the trends and how they change with the environment.
Yeah, and how different they are, as you were saying, in cultures. Like there was at the same time that thing was happening in the States, and it was a huge to-do, there was a soccer coach in England who got nabbed coming out of a massage parlor, you know, with happy endings and all that. And the press was there and snapping all these pictures. And they said, do you know there are Thai hookers in there? He said, of course I know there are Thai hookers in there. That's why I go there. And it was like, what? How dare you not be ashamed, you know? And then they went and interviewed his wife. And his wife said, oh, God, if I could get him to go to Thai hookers twice a week, I'd pay for it. It relaxes him. He's better at his job. You know, how is this any of your business? just completely trumped the assumption that she'd be ashamed and run away from it. Like, hey, this is none of your damn business.
Sounds like he got a good wife. He nailed it.
Imagine if the Clintons had done that.
Maybe they did in private. You know, maybe.
Well, I think they did.
Maybe Hillary was just mad that he wasn't bringing chicks home. I mean, who knows? Who fucking cares either,
exactly.
Right?
Whose business is it?
It's just so weird how the desire for sex and our appetite for sex is not represented in any way. I mean, it's represented a bit in the media and film and in advertising and stuff like that, but it's not honestly engaged. It's not honestly described.
It's funny, though, because like I saw this commercial a couple weeks ago for some plunger or some plumbing thing to clear your drains. And the idea was, and it was, you know, the whatever the major brand plumbing thing is. And this stuff has the chemical nastiness, but it also has like a plastic thing you can stick down to pull the hair thing out. And so it was like double action, right? And so the ad was, this woman answers the door, and it's this really good-looking dude, and the dude's like, yeah, I'm here to snake your drain, baby. Ooh. And she says, oh, and she's like all flustered, and oh, yes, come with me. And then someone else knocks, and she opens, it's another dude, and he's like, yeah, I'm here to help. Oh, two of you. Oh,
What country?
It's here, in the States. And I linked to it. I tweeted it. I said, has this actually been on TV? Because someone sent me the link on YouTube. I said, has anyone seen this on TV? And a bunch of people wrote back and said, oh, yeah, I've seen it on TV. It's on. I'm like, wow. Wow. What's up with that?
Well, congratulations, whatever company put that out. Congratulations for sneaking that through. Can we end on that? Can we pull that commercial?
Pull it up.
What's it called?
It's quite good. It's I think it's Plunger, Dual Action Plunger, or whatever that chemical.
See if you can find that, dude. Dual action plunger. That's hilarious.
And the woman's like in the grocery store and she sees these two guys and has this whole fantasy.
What's going on with that TV show?
Well, it's great, man. Last time I was here, I guess we talked probably off the air about it a little bit. Like a whole shitload of production companies want to do it.
Everybody thinks
it's going to go.
Is this it?
Yeah.
Double Impact.
Double impact, she said.
Here to snake your drain.
She's hot, too. He's hot, too.
Mike, come on in.
I'm here to flush your pipe.
Okay.
What a good kid. Wow, she's letting her hair down and everything. Meanwhile, he's going to go upstairs, and it's just nothing but shit floating in her bowl. And she takes these massive logs.
Yeah, look at her poop.
Yeah, these fucking wood chips.
Make a sword out of that.
It's just snot and blood.
You got the Barry White voiceover.
And she just woke up. That's her fantasy. Yeah, the undersex housewife. Shit's reality. And the gay guy holding the fruit.
The melons.
Gay guy working with the melons. The two of them are just going to use her as an excuse to get together. That's how they're doing.
I get that.
That's what double penetration is. When two guys, when they're both in the vagina at the same time, they're just using the woman as a container so they could rub dicks.
Become scrotum buddies.
Yeah, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Listen, fascinating again. 3 hours just flew right by, man.
Yeah.
We could do this every time. We still talked about like one paragraph in your book.
we'll cover it one page.
But it's a brilliant book. And folks, if you haven't read it, it's called Sex at Dawn. You can get it on Amazon, which is a sponsor of the show. It's available as an audio book. It's also available, of course, in book form, and it's fucking great. And you were working on another book, too.
Civilized to Death.
Is that coming out soon?
It's due October 1st, should come out next spring, unless I don't get to it. But
all right.
I'm going to start real soon.
Sex at Dawn, it's available now. And your podcast, how do people get it?
Tangentially speaking, you can get it at feralaudio.com or you can get it on iTunes.
It's on iTunes, beautiful. Yeah. And it's Chris Ryan, PhD, on Twitter. And thanks, brother. Really appreciate it.
Really
fun.
Enjoyed it.
Always good times. All right, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks, everybody, came out to Nashville this weekend. We had a great fucking time. Nashville was awesome. It was exactly what I needed. I wanted to go to a small club and work out some new material. And, man, there's nothing like working at a comedy club. I've been doing a lot of theaters lately. I forgot how much fun it is to do a weekend, like a 300-seater. Nashville is awesome. What a fucking great town. Thank you, everybody, who came out, because I had the time of my life. It was beautiful. And Tommy Buns was with me as well, Tom Segura.
That's great.
We had a great time. It was seriously some of the best sets I've ever had in my life. You people are amazing. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you go to squarespace.com/Joe, you can sign up. You don't even have to use your credit card. But if you decide to sign up, use the code name Joe and the number 3, and you will save yourself some moolah, you sexy bitches. And you're like, no way, Joe. And I'm like, yeah, way. Save some money, and it's an awesome fucking website. We're also brought to you by onnit.com. That's O-N-N-I-T. Use the code name Rogan, and you can save yourself 10% off any and all supplements. Go to rogan.ting.com. That is our last and final sponsor. That's Ting. Ting is the cell phone company that doesn't have contracts and rolls over your minutes, and they're just basically badass. Rogan.ting.com will save you $25 off either service or a phone. We'll be back tomorrow with the great Bill Burr, one of my favorite human beings and one of the funniest comics working today. Yeah. And so we'll see you then, you fucks. We love the shit out of you, and we'll see you soon. Big kiss. Mwah.